handy saddlebag, and a quick stop racing brake. Braking, winning, spinning. It's the Big Wheel with saddlebag and racing brake. Big Wheel by Marks. If we make it, it can take it.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
You're coming in clear, which is a good sign.
Yeah, that's good. I was wondering about that.
Yeah, the very first time, usually, there's something.
Yeah, I tried out last night when I logged in. I tried out some like little test things to see how it was going, but I figured that would only tell me so much.
Yeah, well, that's clear. That's a good sign. How are you doing?
Off to a good start.
Yeah, you're ready to talk some old comics?
Yeah.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to start this is because I've been lax in reading all my old stuff.
Yeah.
And it gives me motivation to do that and also historically learn stuff that I want to learn about
right.
that I haven't read and then revisit stuff that I want to revisit.
Yeah, because you said that you started reading Back Issue Magazine, right? That was part of it?
Yeah, I started reading those articles, and I'm like, this shit's cool.
Yeah, they're really good. I took like a little break from buying them because they were piling up. Because they, in between reading, you know, reading all the comics and everything, and then reading those,
yeah,
I was getting behind on reading them. But yeah, they're definitely some like really awesome articles.
And that's another reason I want to read it. Plus, I buy all these books like on history and stuff, you know, like those DC ones and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I never really sit down and read them, and I figure it's a good opportunity for that too.
Yeah, sometimes even if like the old comics, sometimes even if the comics themselves aren't that great, sometimes the story behind them and the history involved is still interesting.
Yeah. Or funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I was speaking of Back Issue Magazine and funny, I haven't finished it yet because it's almost the whole issue. It's our interview with Jeanette Kahn from DC.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes basically through her whole career and everything. And I got about halfway through, but part of it I was just reading, she was talking about, you know, when they were going over to England to try to recruit, you know, Alan Moore and Grant Morrison and all those guys. And they had like a big party to socialize with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like her and Karen Berger and Dick Giordano went over. And she was saying that, you know, their accents were always like, you know, they would meet one creator, you know, like Alan Moore, and then they'd meet, you know, Grant Morrison. He's Scottish. So everyone was speaking English, but they had trouble, you know, they had to adapt to each person's accent.
Yeah, it's very strange. Sometimes I could talk to people in England, and they're just different parts of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a big difference.
even though it's a small country.
Yeah.
But she said that her and Karen were really struggling, and they were watching Dick Giordano walk around. And by that point, he was already, I think, you know, older. And he's just walking around, seems like he's like really comfortable, and he's just smiling and laughing, shaking hands with everybody. It doesn't seem like he's having any problems. And they're asking him later, like, what his secret was. And he told them that he knew with his, by then I guess he was wearing hearing aids, and he knew with the problems that he was having with his hearing and stuff, that he wouldn't be able to understand anybody anyways. So he just turned his hearing aids off and like just walked around and like smiled and laughed, and he was like, didn't even understand what people were saying.
Yeah, sounds like my family. My mom can't understand Barb because she's a soft talker, and my mom's side of the family is close to deaf. I mean, I even have some, you know, little bit of bad hearing.
Yeah,
but yeah, she kind of reads lips, and sometimes she just can't hear what Barb says, or she hears something totally different.
Yeah.
And just shakes her heads and smiles.
Yeah.
Kind of like Dick did.
Yeah, I'll probably be like that someday. My grandma's like that with me and my dad, you know, because we tend to talk sort of low, and we mumble sometimes. And yeah. she'll look at us, like, shaking her head, and she'll look at my mom to have my mom tell her what she was like. She's kind of confused, but oh well. But
so, Chris, I thought we'd introduce ourselves as this being the first episode and all, and also tell, you know, about your blog and kind of like your history with comics just in general.
Yeah, sure. Where are we going to go with, like, just Geek Brunch Retro or something like that?
Put it yeah, in yeah. This is going to be like a Geek Brunch Retro. It'll be on the Geek Brunch feed. I'll be releasing it, like, on every opposite of Geek Brunch. I'll probably even invite, like, the other Geek Brunch dudes if they want to talk some old stuff on, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It would be cool to talk to
other people. They can join us. Mike is really into back issues right now.
Nice. So,
if they want to join us, they can join us. But it's going to be loose format. Because I find that to be easier because you never know with tangents and stuff where something will take you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd like to keep it within, you know, anything past 10 years old or so, if you don't mind.
Yeah. No, I think it's good to have at least a loose breakdown because, you know, between Geek Brunch and DC Noise, you pretty much cover a lot of the newer stuff.
Yeah. And, you know. So, yeah, this is I'm excited for it because, like, I even went to some boxes to find books to pick, you know, like stuff that was old that I wanted to read that I haven't read. I mean, I have a lot of books that I haven't read.
Yeah.
So it's like, and a lot of it was, you know, filling in gaps because I'm like a DC completist in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So like I would buy a lot like from mycomicshop.com. I'd like go on a Spurge and I'd look at I use this thing called Comic Base.
Mm-hmm.
And I find holes in my collection every now and then and we'll fill those holes like, oh, I was in college this year and I missed these minis or whatever and I'll go pick them up, but then I never read them.
Right.
So, yeah, I've got complete collections and stuff, but a lot of books I don't even know what they're about, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. No, I do the same thing because I remember, like, sometime last year, Kara said, like, wait, you have comics you haven't read yet? Because she, like, you know, she had a background of, like, reading, you know, some graphic novels and things like that. She tends to gravitate more towards stuff that's, like, autobiographical, like
True Story, like, swear to God, has she tried that?
I don't think she's tried that, but she, like, you know, she's like, when we met, she had already read like Mouse and Persepolis and things like that, you know, she kind of gravitates towards, but yeah, I was laughing because I'll tend to, you know, I'll collect the back issues and I'll try to, you know, I like shopping for back issues, but I like to bargain hunt, you know, I like to try to find. It's not often that I spend a lot on a single issue, and I try to get deals. So, you know, a lot of times if you want to buy a run that's complete, especially on, like, eBay or something, you're going to pay more. But if you, you know, if you just get, like, random issues here and there and then, you know, just try to track it down, the ones that are missing in between, you end up not spending as much money. So I'll do that.
Yeah, that could turn out to be real cheap if you find the right shipping cost.
Yeah, because I started using, for a while I was using Comic Collector Live.
Yeah.
And I didn't pay to re-up the software, but I still use the their website for back issue shopping because a lot of you can shop a lot of stores at once and. A lot of the stores will have free shipping for, depending on how much you want to spend, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's usually $25 or more. But that's how I found out that you guys were, I can't remember if it was DC Noise or Geek Brunch, but I think you guys were talking about Brett's comic pile.
Oh, yeah, it was DC Noise. Keith had been there.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because Robert Atkins was talking about it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had, I've bought some stuff from him through there. because his collection, I mean, he's got so much stuff that sometimes it's just convenient to be able to find everything in one place, you know?
Yeah. And I'll impulse buy too. Sometimes I'll, at a con, I'll like just see a cover that's striking and not really even care about what's inside the comic.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll just buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good to do that. I don't do that enough, you know?
Yeah.
I'm always like, you get caught up in the same things or searching for specific things. And every once in a while, I've been doing that a lot, like trying stuff. That's one thing that's been good about Comixology is I'll just download anything that's free, and I've actually run into some new stuff that way.
Yeah, Comixology is great to, and they're getting more and more old stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
So and those are usually cheaper, which I like.
Right. Yeah. To keep it focused on that, on the back issue thing, that actually is becoming a way for people to, you know, track down or find stuff you don't want to have to go through. I mean, I enjoy, that's one of the things I enjoy is hunting for back issues and stuff, so I enjoy that, but especially with some stuff, though, if it hasn't been reprinted, you know, I mean, depending on what area you're interested in, you can, like, some stuff still gets pricey.
Oh, yeah. They're rare, too. I mean, it's all about availability.
Right.
And some of those obscure titles cost a little bit more because there just wasn't as many in print.
Yeah, or even just like there'll be random issues that, like, I was recently looking at like issues that tied into Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Right.
And you know, some of them are really easy to get, and then I think it was like the very last issue of Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. Before it relaunched, I think it's like 289 or something like that.
Right.
I guess it must have been a low print run, and because of that, it's, you know, it's harder to find a cheap issue.
Yeah, Wonder Woman had a lot of low print runs. I've just recently tried to start feeling that because I was reading some 12-cent Wonder Woman and 10-cent Wonder Woman, and I just found it goofy fun.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got to start filling it in. And that's one title that I'm enjoying filling in, like cons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they get pricey though. The Wonder Woman's, just because I think there's not a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Was it not as popular at the time, or?
Well, it was their least selling, one of their least selling titles, but there's some good comics. I mean, there's that. I was recently reading the jumpsuit era where she's in that white jumpsuit, like when she lost her powers and just was using kung fu.
Yeah.
So it's like,
so crazy.
Yeah.
That was, what's his face? Who was the writer on those?
I can't remember if it was Michelini or, God, I just don't remember.
It was the same.
They recently released some trades on it.
Yeah, and I got all those DC retroactives that came out.
Oh, yeah.
One of those was the only reason I ended up getting. I had pre-ordered the Flash ones because I'm a big Flash fan, but I ended up finding a store that was selling the ones I didn't get for like 99 cents a piece, mm-hmm. which is so I ended up getting the rest of them. But yeah, one of them was focused on the era of Wonder Woman as the. Was it Shang-Chi or who was. Not Shang-Chi, but.
Chang.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zai Chen. I can't remember his first name, but he was blind. Yeah. And then she had that, like, spy boyfriend or such. Like, it wasn't Steve Trevor. It was this other dude. I can't remember what his name was.
Oh, it was Denny O'Neill, wasn't it?
It was the Denny O'Neill run.
That was driving me crazy, but yeah. Yeah, I know I read something somewhere where he was talking about that era where, you know, because he did a lot for Green Arrow and Green Lantern and Batman and everything, and talking about, I mean, it's fun to go back and read those, and it's a crazy idea, but, you know, it's kind of funny seeing him recollect it and, like, being like, yeah, well, maybe that idea wasn't the greatest in terms of of changing her that way.
But. Yeah, but his, I'll give him credit, his stories stand out today still as being good to me. You know, like, yeah. I can read his stuff, and I still enjoy it quite a bit.
Yeah, I want to go back and read more of his old stuff because I had gotten curious about when he, like, when Green Lantern went to being just Green Lantern again after being Green Lantern and Green Arrow for a long time. And, you know, they pushed that Hal was going back out into space and all that stuff. And so this was like right around 1980, and he was still writing it for a little while. And I read like a little bit of a run there of his issues. And, you know, compared to some stuff, like, I'm totally willing to give it the benefit of the doubt or whatever you want to call it in terms of acknowledging the era that it, the, like, if you're reading something old, you gotta, like, I gotta look at like when it came out and be willing to give it some concessions to the different style that they wrote and everything. But like his stuff, like you said, really holds up, like, it compared to other stuff in that era. I didn't really find it to be that dated.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the Silver Age and Bronze Age. The one mm-hmm. age that I have that I've been exploring, but I have a hard time with, is the Golden Age.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but they're really dense. I mean, really dense.
Yeah.
And they have very similar formulas. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really gotten into it, but I have been getting into, like, the Golden Age. Sometimes I can find the Marvel family and Shazams mm-hmm. for relatively not inexpensive, but I'm talking about under 50.
Yeah.
Like in good condition. In other words, the paper quality is good. The covers are kind of ratty.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed those. I could mm-hmm. kind of see how he threatened Superman at the time. You know, he was the more popular character.
Yeah.
Because they were just more fun comics.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, especially when you're talking about Golden Age, you got like, cheap is relative, you know, like you're only gonna get so cheap when you're talking about. Yeah, I find, like, I haven't tried to read too much Golden stuff, but I found one thing I really do like is when Golden Age concepts and characters are written written about now, like with a modern sensibility.
Oh, hell yeah. Just like, you know, JSA, like back when Geoff Johns took over it. And it actually makes you interested in researching those characters in the past. At least for me, it did. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, this is this incarnation. I want to go read about the original incarnation.
Yeah, yeah, to see where that came from and stuff. Like all the stuff that, you know, Roy Thomas definitely did a lot of that kind of stuff for DC, pulling out just really obscure characters and coming up with new concepts and stuff, but...
And I really like villains. So the one thing that I think I did good when I was in college and books were a lot cheaper is I would look for first appearances of the Batman Rogues Galleries and the Flash mm-hmm. Rogues.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of, like, you know, Captain Boomerang, Captain Cold, the Top, and then I'll have, like, Scarecrow, not the Golden Age, just the first Silver Age appearances, you know.
Yeah.
Scarecrow, mm-hmm. Riddler, and stuff like that. But I'm glad mm-hmm. I picked them up because they're books that are, you know, always moving up in value, actually. Mm-hmm. Not that I so much care about that, but there's a lot of historical significance to them that I really like, and I like to have them on my shelf.
Yeah, and I mean, people talk about comics aren't worth anything or they're not an investment anymore, and it's not really true. It's just not, like, the way that people thought about it in the 90s and that whole boom of, like, current stuff coming up. I mean, you see it a little bit briefly, like, you know, so I saw somebody tweeting about the fact that right now, like, the new, you know, Batman issues, like, selling for, you know, $15-$20 on eBay or whatever, but that's just, like, really brief.
Oh, yeah, that's short term. But my God, is that new Batman good?
I haven't read it yet because I get...
Oh, number 13 will blow your mind. I was actually terrified when I read it. There's a scene in there with Joker, and I was like, this is like watching, you know, like a horror movie at midnight. This is awful.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, get mine... monthly. So that'll be in my next shipment. But yeah, Scott Snyder, I think, is really, really awesome. But yeah, like, it's still, there's like, if you make an investment, like you said, at one point, stuff from the 70s was still affordable, but that stuff is all really, you know, taken off in price. And yeah. I think, you know, I've been, it's one of the reasons I've been focusing on buying a lot of stuff from the 80s that I want in case the same stuff happens.
Yeah, people sometimes tweet me or send me emails and they're like, I have these issues and are they worth money? And it's, and usually they're not. And I just said the general rule of thumb is anything Bronze Age or earlier is, you know, has value. And the modern stuff doesn't unless it's got demand and it's scarce or it's a key appearance, you know?
Yeah.
So, but the 90s, well, I never thought the 90s were bad, though. In other words, I still got books in the 90s, and I found some of them still really good. I mean, there was a lot of good stuff that came out. There's a lot of bad stuff that came out, too.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of excitement in the 90s just because of the explosion of other companies that could compete with the big two.
Right.
I mean, Valiant, I absolutely love. I mean, to this day.
Yeah. That.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say that it's easy to generalize about the 90s, but like you said, there was a lot of good stuff too.
Yeah. Well, I followed like the Jim Shooter out of Valiant into Defiant and Broadway and everything else he did, and I found all of those companies good. And I really loved Malibu, believe it or not. When that company came, you know, like Prime and the Strangers and stuff, I thought that was like so refreshing. And it, Marvel just destroyed it. I mean, they bought the property. Yeah. And I think they were headed to like a good popularity because you could like watch Ultra Force on, you know, Netflix instant streaming. And they had media. So
yeah, they were trying to I didn't at the time read any Malibu, but as I've like gone back and learned a little bit about, I still haven't read really anything from them, but there's a trying to think of, cuz you know the blog Longbox Graveyard.
Yeah.
The guy that runs
He wrote a few of those issues.
Yeah, he was it's definitely a good blog for anybody to check out. But yeah, he was involved in writing some stuff for Malibu, and he connected I think it's We Talk Comics is the name of the podcast that had an interview with some of the guys that were really heavily involved with Malibu, and it's a really good interview because one of the guys, he actually Paul, I believe his name is, that runs Longbox Graveyard, he works with one of the guys from Malibu currently, and it was a really, really interesting interview if people want to track it down. Because they just went into the whole history of, you know, how Malibu got started and what they were trying to accomplish with their superhero line. And like you said, they were really, really trying to cross over into other media to get people interested in their properties and stuff. And it's interesting to look back at how the differences between Marvel and DC have both acquired a lot of companies and properties. And historically, they seem to have handled how they, you know, what they do with those properties very differently.
Yeah, I think DC, to me, is a little more successful. I'm not going to say they everything is a big, you know, hit, but they do tend to keep at least, you know, Captain Marvel in the limelight. The Question sometimes shows up, like he was really big in 52. And, you know, Blue Beetle had his own comic in several incarnations, and you see some of the other characters that they've acquired in like Suicide Squad and some other stuff, but Marvel seems to, like, they try once and then that's it. If it doesn't hit, it's done. Like, they recently mm-hmm. did it with CrossGen.
Yep, I was just thinking of that.
Yeah, CrossGen, and then they... What else did they... Oh, Malibu was a perfect example. That didn't last yeah. more than a year, you know?
Yeah.
So, I was reading back issue, and I found... It was an article about Lord Pumpkin, who was created by a guy I wasn't even aware of, and then Aaron LaPriesti, who I am aware of because I love his art, and yeah, I just bought a Conan sketch from him like at a con this year, and that was awesome because I've never thought I would get one of the sketch from him, but I'm a fan of his stuff. So he did like Lord Pumpkin, and he's currently doing that Amethyst New 52 series, which I really like. But yeah. What I found interesting in that article is like the very first page or two. Harley's coming in, and I got to watch the door because she still doesn't know that we try to keep the door open for her, but right. sometimes I close it, and she just runs in, and she hits the door. It's like, bang! And she hasn't, like, conditioned herself yet because the first time she knocked herself out, she kind of did. She got cautious, but now she's doing it again.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually have Luna's laying on the floor right behind me.
Yeah, Harley was watching Arrow with me last night. That was hilarious.
Yeah, I saw that. That was awesome.
It's weird because she, like, gets her attention on something and she doesn't, like, you know, change her attention. It's weird. She really pays attention to things.
Yeah, she looked like she was pretty into it.
She even hit the iPad with her nose a couple times and stopped it. That's hilarious. She's freaking hilarious.
Yeah.
That's so far, awesome. She's left my comics alone, but
mm-hmm.
I named her Harley Quinn for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, my parents' cat, when my comics used to be at their house, like he was obsessed with, or he still is, like, obsessed with, like, chewing on plastic and stuff.
Oh, so, really? The polypropylene?
Yeah. Oh, man, he was terrible with... I'd come in and there'd be, like, a comic book bag... Or he'd get, you know, just, like, he'd get his nose into the little hole, like, the handhold at the end of the comic box.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the first issue that was in there, the bag that was in was all, had all chew marks all over it and stuff. But my cat now, he doesn't, because we have a cat and a dog, he doesn't seem to bother him with them that much, which is good.
Yeah, Harley came from, that's the one thing that she's getting used to. She came from a foster of a couple of dogs and 8 cats.
Oh, my
and now
gosh.
Now she's in a home with just us, so...
Yeah.
She's adapting. But she sleeps a lot. I don't know if it's the Great Dane in her, but she can sleep a whole 10 hours if you don't watch... If you don't keep her going. But oh then she's really active the rest of the time. Like, when I leave for work, she'll... find shit and cause problems.
Yeah. So, yeah, Luna sleeps a lot, but it's because she's like 12 years old, so she's getting up there. But
yeah, our dog Scooter went to 13, and mm-hmm. Risa before that was 12, and they were healthy too. It just said they got the cancer that just ate them away.
Yeah. Yeah, she's getting up there, and I mean, she's pretty healthy, but we notice. Each summer gets tougher and tougher for with the heat, you know, just panting all the time. And I mean, she was my girlfriend's dog
mm-hmm.
Before we started dating. So, I mean, my girlfriend's had her for over 10 years now. So she's real, you know, keeps a close eye on her, anything that's going wrong or anything, because it's tough when they get older.
Yeah. Our dog, we had to do many things for, like, diabetes, you know, we'd have to give him insulin in the morning and then at night.
Oh, man.
I never thought I could do that, but when it's your own dog, because I've always hated needles and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you get really attached, though.
Yeah. You know? There's a reason they're called man's best friend.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I guess maybe we should just call this Geek Brunch Tangent.
Yeah.
But you were saying, like, 20 minutes ago about, because introducing myself.
Yeah.
Because I guess a lot of people may be familiar with you, but this is actually, people listening, this is actually the first time that we've ever talked.
Yes.
At least not through social media.
It's always been Twitter or through a forum or something.
Yeah, which, because I think it was about a year ago now, started connecting with you guys, DC Noise and stuff like that, through Twitter and the forums and stuff. But but yeah, my name's Chris Ivey. yeah, I guess, I mean, I did, like you said, I have my friends and I have a website. It's criticalmassesmedia.com. And it's been sort of sporadic lately, but I have a column there that I write some stuff about comics sometimes called Myth Making, etc. And I'm Myth Making, etc. on Twitter and on the forums stuff. But yeah, I did. One of the things I did, a blog post about comics that I started to try to figure out what were some of the first comics I read were. And I'll give a shout out to website Mike's Amazing World of Comics, because that was really helpful, because you can, on that website, you can actually like browse different publishers, what they put out month by month, and look at the covers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the way I knew it was Marvel that I had read. And that was kind of the way I figured it out, because I could remember the covers and I just kind of was browsing through. And I know that, you know, I kind of figured out that it was probably around like 86 that I started reading. And I was born in 79, so I was like 7 at the time.
So you're 10 years younger.
Yeah. but yeah, I know my parents, you could get like, they had packs of like 3 or more comics together, and you could see, you know, 2 of them, and then like you didn't know what was in between them.
But wouldn't you try to see it? I would.
later on when I was like responsible for shopping and stuff, you try to figure it out. Yeah, like there wasn't much room to move it, but if you like try to slide it with your thumbs a little bit and see on the edges or something,
at least the corner, so you can see an issue number or maybe a title.
Yeah, but yeah, I think my parents brought some of those home for me, and you know, I was thinking it's kind of funny how nowadays, you know, you try to read each part of a story, and you know, back then I just got whatever came in those packs, and I just got whatever, you know, it'd be a couple years before I would start, like, this would lead into me going, you know, getting rides to the comic shop and stuff. But early on, you know, I just had a stack of Marvel comics, and they weren't consecutive issues, or, you know, and I would just read the ones that I had over and over. And so that's why I think, like, so what I did in this blog post is, like, once I found a couple covers that I recognize, I have this Marvel Digital Unlimited subscription, so I looked for a couple issues there, and it was kind of cool. Like when I looked at the cover, you know, I couldn't tell you anything about what was inside, but as soon as I started flipping through the issue, you know, it started all coming back to me.
Yeah,
you know, and I could remember being, so like one of them was Avengers 273, which came out in, looks like came out in like August of 86, and it's a Roger Stern story with John Buscema art. And as soon as I started flipping through it, I could remember being a kid and reading it, because like it turned out to be a really good introduction for me, because it starts out with Hercules is in a bar, and he's holding up a table with a bunch of people from the bar are like on top of the table, and it ends up, he goes up to the bar and it ends up being, I think it was, yeah, it ended up being the Wrecker.
I have a fond appreciation for the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're all involved in this, and like the Wrecker's out of costume, so he doesn't recognize him. And he starts bragging about the Avengers, and he's basically telling the Wrecker like all this information about the team. And this, you know, the side effect of that for me as a reader was, it's like, you know, it gave me an introduction right there to who was on the team and who, you know, what was up with them.
That's the difference between comics today and comics then, is it's much harder to pick up issue 5 or something of something and know what's going on. Like, you can join on issue 5, but you might have to read 6 and 7 to get into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas back then, and I've learned that just preparing for this podcast, because I didn't have an issue 1 of this series, and I just decided to read issue 2, and I got right into it. Do you know what I mean? They gave you enough to know what the heck was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I noticed I was trying to, like, this morning I was trying to find a few more from the same era of Marvel that I had read when I was a kid, and I realized that, so this was issue 273, I realized that I also had 276. So, you know, it's the same storyline. Basically, it all involves the Masters of Evil and Baron Zemo and this huge team, and they take over Avengers Mansion. And
that's one of the most popular arcs.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I think it's. I think it was in a trade paperback called Under Siege.
Yeah, they beat the crap out of the Butler, too.
Yeah, that was actually, so I read 276 again, and so, in other words, like, I skipped 2 issues. You know, I didn't have the in-between issues, and, you know, but I just read the next one that I had, and, yeah, like you were saying, Captain America and Black Knight are tied up, and Mr. Hyde is, and I remember this as a kid, like, kind of being shocked by it, because you don't actually see any violence, but the reaction of Captain America and Black Knight to what Mr. Hyde is doing to Jarvis.
Yeah.
Avengers, but like the way that they drew the panel is you only see Mr. Hyde's back and like a little bit of Jarvis, but they're so horrified, and like later on, you know, basically he pummels them to like within an inch of death.
Right. It just shows that things can be scary and frightening without actually showing the gore and the physical action behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have no problem with that as an adult, but as a kid, like, it was scary enough to me just, you know, seeing the way that they depicted it without it being, like, shown.
Yeah.
You know, it was appropriate for me, but it was also still creepy. Yeah, I mean, getting back to, you know, my background, like, eventually I started, like I said, actually going to comic shops, and when I was a kid I pretty much read Marvel exclusively. I was a big Spider-Man fan, and then, you know, my buddy when I was a kid and I were, I think back then it was more about the art for me.
Same for me. Like, yeah. Like when I first got it, it wasn't even, I wouldn't even read all the bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sometimes I would like just not get some of it. Like one of the other issues I read, old Marvel issues I read was like Thor 373 for that blog post I did, and I remembered half of it. You know, some of the pages I could tell I paid a lot of attention to, because they were really, like, they definitely came back to me. And then other pages, which reading as an adult, I could tell had to do with, like, more of the overall, like, they were kind of subplots that were going, this is, like, part of Walter Simonson's run.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it had to do with, like, more of, like, the overall storyline that was going on in the book at the time. And I don't remember those pages at all. It just, I think, because when I was a kid, it didn't make sense to me. So I just focused on the stuff that did, which was like the way that it tied into like the mutant massacre storyline and stuff with X Factor, because it ends with Angel pinned to the wall by his wings in the sewer.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful image.
Yeah, and that definitely, I know that definitely stayed with me. But, yeah, so at first, when Image got started, we were pretty into that at first, because that was, and my taste definitely changed, like, but that was a lot of the artists at the time that we were into were all the ones that went to Image. So we were pretty excited about that, but then, and that was kind of like that, the first couple of years of Image were the first, that was kind of the end of my first time collecting comics. It was in high school and stuff, I kind of got out of it for a while.
Yeah. Did you have friends that, you said you had one friend that you, that collected comics too, or?
Yeah, I had a couple. There was like one or two, and definitely, and I would have been, I think, in middle school at the time. This buddy, Garrett, we were both like into comics. Our parents would like take turns taking us to the local comic shop, and we would trade stuff all the time. Like, we were like ridiculous in the stuff that we would trade. Like, we'd do these huge trades sometimes, not just involving comics and stuff. And my mom would get mad at me because the like, I'd be trading like stuff that they bought for me, and we'd do these huge trades.
Do you know what you just gave away? You know how I paid on that?
Yeah, we'd like spend like the whole day like working out this trade, you know?
Yeah. You'll get these comics plus an X-Wing fighter for that TIE fighter.
Right. Yeah. It's like this Stephen King book, this.
Yeah. You know, and the baseball cards and football cards.
Yeah. It was insane, you know?
It was the same in my day. It was all negotiation.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was cool because you get to read stuff that, like, we were both into, really into Todd McFarlane's art. And even back then, I mean, those were like the most expensive. I think still one of the most I've spent on a comic book was back then, you know, and it was a lot of money. Like, I saved up to get one of the McFarlane Spider-Man issues. And,
that's amazing, know, so, how fast they went in price. Back in that time frame.
Yeah, because this would have been only like a year or two after they came out. And
it also was amazing how powerful Wizard was. All that had to happen was Wizard publish an article saying what's hot. Right. And then all of a sudden, the thing would skyrocket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I totally remember. I mean, that was one of the things I was thinking about and get ready for this podcast was just back then how you used to get your information, you know, without the internet. Like, every once in a while, so I order back issues, like I said, in the mail, and every once in a while they'll throw a comic shop news in there. And it's funny now, I just like, I kind of glance at it for like nostalgia's sake, but everything in there I already know because of the internet.
Yeah.
But back in the day, I mean, if I went to the shop and bought comics and they didn't put it in my bag, I'd be pissed off because, like, you know, we'd get that and we'd pour through it. And, you know, when Wizard magazine started showing up, I mean, we'd get that. And I mean, there was no internet. Like, that was the way you found out about new stuff coming out.
Yep. I really enjoyed Wizard at the time. It was like that and Previews or whatever the heck was the Previews competition at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was like Christmas catalog shopping Wizard, I hate to say it, but at the time it would influence a lot what I bought. Like, if they had an article on something, I would likely try it.
Yeah, yeah, and I vividly remember, you know, like looking at the list of who they considered to be top artists and stuff at the time, and they always had their, you know, and they, it wasn't very accurate, but, you know, they had the price guide in the back, and I'd go through the price guide looking at the little, you know, they'd pick an issue here and there of a back issue to show, you know, just show the cover and a little bit about it. And, you know, that was a way that you find out about things too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I said, I mean, that was kind of when I got out of comics, in the early 90s. And I definitely missed some of the stuff that people complain about the 90s. I sort of missed. And it really wasn't till What got me back into collecting was I was definitely an X-Men fan, like the early Jim Lee stuff and all that. When the first X-Men movie was going to be coming out, I started reading the Marvel Essentials collections of the, Chris Claremont stuff. And the first time I went to a comic shop again was because I had heard I was in college, he was coming back to the X-Men. And like a lot of people, I wasn't too crazy, about what I found, but that's what got me back into the shop, and I ended up finding other stuff on the shelves.
Yeah, sounds like you switched to DC at some point.
Yeah, so that was kind of like my... And yeah, at some point, like I said, I didn't really... So that's part of my fascination with going back. I spend a lot of time going back to like the 80s DC stuff, because I wasn't really reading. I mean, I did have like a Batman issue here or there, and I remember a particular issue of Firestorm, it was like a Firestorm issue against where he fought Captain Atom, but for whatever reason, I just wasn't interested. Like, there was this kid down the street I remember was into DC, and he was reading Nightfall, and he's like, tell me, nobody. He breaks Batman's back. It's awesome. And I was just wasn't interested for some reason. He's like trying to sell me on it and like how awesome it was. And I was like, eh, whatever. But I went through a phase of kind of just reading. I just got, like I said, I got more into following writers. And I kind of bought a mix. But yeah, in recent years, I definitely have become like pretty heavy DC. And that's kind of, I would say, as far as collecting back stuff, I mean, I read a mix of things as far as new stuff, but as far as collecting back issues, I've kind of decided to focus on, just because you can't buy everything, I've kind of decided to focus on collecting old DC stuff just to sort of have a focus.
That's kind of what my focus is. And I haven't picked a time period. I'd love to have every DC comic from like 1973 up. And that's kind of like a goal I've been, after.
Yeah.
Well, I never really stopped. That's the thing, So I've always had some DC.
Right.
I've always been in and out of Marvel, so I'm a little bit different. Even though my fondest memory is very similar to yours, was the Defenders issue with the Sons of the Serpent, when they took out the whole Defenders and Yellow Jacket and a bunch of other characters I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. had to come and rescue the day. But I've always been factuated with B-list characters. I don't know what it is, but
yeah,
when I saw the Son of Satan on the cover, with the pentagram on his chest, I was like, what the hell is this? Yeah. Why is he a good guy? I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in the 70s, they were a lot more willing to use, Satanism and stuff like that as a plot.
And he was a hero, though. He was fighting his father, and I was like, what the heck? This is just weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's... Even in movies and stuff like that from the 70s, Satanism was a lot bigger.
Right.
That sounds weird to say, but...
The Exorcist. Satanism
was popular.
And, yeah. Omen and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It's still a facet that still creeps me out. Like, even in the 80s or maybe it was the 90s when Stigmata came out and a couple of those... For some reason, religion and horror scares me.
I think it's plausible. I think it's more plausible.
Yeah, The Exorcist still frightens me to this day. The bedroom scene. It freaks me out. Like, I even have trouble watching it by myself. And that's a whole movie.
I know, and I I watched it again a couple years ago, and like what, like some of that, some of it's still shocking. Like what she does with the crucifix.
Yeah.
It's just like, I couldn't believe that they put that in the movie. Like, it's just, it's still surprising.
Yeah.
Still shocking, even now, you know. I don't even know if they would do that now. In some ways, like some stuff that you see from the 70s.
Yeah, I think they were a little more open in the 70s. Mm-hmm. I know that my parents never sheltered me from not seeing a rated R movie, I'll tell you that. So I saw a lot of horror movies that as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I like horror in general. It's one of my things, even though I haven't watched a lot, and it's the month of October.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I know. At least this upcoming weekend, I got to get a few in. Last October, Kara had never seen the original Halloween.
that one is so, my movie.
I was going to say, not to bring up your namesake, but that's a favorite of mine. A lot of times I'll watch that around Halloween, and she hadn't seen it. So
it's amazing how popular that is, because a lot of people don't mention the comedian or all that stuff. It's always Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go to the bank. Oh, you're Mike Myers. And it's even spelled the same.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I'm surprised more people don't bring up.
So what got you in
Powers.
to blogging about comics?
Well, I guess the website started originally. Me and a couple of college friends were individually doing our own blogging, and at the time I was writing about music, and we were all visiting each other's sites and stuff, so we came up with the idea to create a site and just put all of our stuff in one place together. And it's like, if just for the idea of like, okay, maybe if someone came to check out the site because they know me, maybe they would end up reading something by one of my friends as a result.
Right.
And I just, you know, it was kind of just a way, like, because I'm so focused on comics, and you know, I was doing a lot of taking in information by listening to a lot of podcasts. I listened to a lot of podcasts at work. It was just a way of doing output of some of the stuff that I was writing about, or just some of the stuff I was reading, wanting to do a little bit of writing and just keep, I mean, I did a lot of writing in college, so it was a way of also like trying to keep up those skills.
Right.
But So Myth Making Etc. started originally at the beginning of the year. I recorded a few episodes of a solo podcast. I think because I was doing it's tough to do one by yourself.
It's very tough, because it's tougher to have pauses and stuff, because you're guiding the conversation yourself.
Right.
Whereas if you have multiple people, you don't know where that's going to take you, or what you're going to talk about. Well, you have to plan a lot more when you're doing a solo podcast. Like, to me, I find the podcast that I do, I don't even have to plan for, which kind of makes it kind of fun. I mean, it's just you just go, and wherever the conversation takes you, you go down that route.
Yeah. I think this is already a good example of that.
Yeah.
I do have some stuff that I read and wrote down notes about, but, you know, whatever we get to. But, like you said, I'd find, because I was not talking to somebody, like, you know, when you're talking to somebody else, like, the other person can jump in and the pauses and stuff. And so I'd zone out and think about something. So I had, like, these super long pauses that I had to edit out and... And like you said, it just was a lot of work. I was surprised at how much work it was. So I just kind of phased doing that, and even used like some of my notes to like rewrite some stuff that I did into the blogging. And it's still kind of up in the air. I mean, I just enjoy, like, and I, because the other thing I realized was, the main thing, I'm not so much interested in putting my opinion out there in the way that it's like, bam, this is what I think, and you should all read it, as I am interested in doing this, like having a conversation with somebody. Like,
oh, yeah, that's what makes it fun, is the socialization of your thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what interests me, you know, so it's like I could care less to put myself out there in the way that it's just like, you know, you should read this. This is what I think. And, you know, this is my opinion as I am, like, as a way to, like, get feedback and have a conversation about something. So,
yeah, it's even changed. I mean, that whole concept that you just talked about has changed the way I view cons, too.
Mm-hmm.
I spend more time with my buddies, people that I've met over the internet or blogs or forums or whatever, hanging out than I do at the actual con. It's pretty crazy.
No, it's awesome. No, I'm hoping sometime next year, like 2013, like I'm going to try to get to one of the cons that everyone's going to, to meet some of the people that I've started to interact with on the internet.
I know we're trying to do, I mean, we always try to go to Heroes in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Those seem to be like our, for Geek Brunch and DC Noise and, you know, the Comic Book Noise family and all that stuff, seem to meet over there. We did meet once at Super Show, and they're having another Super Show, so.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's like Daryl Taylor and I actually had the same birthday.
Yeah. Oh, so it's on your birthday.
So it's on our birthday, yeah. So I don't know if that's awesome or if it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, Daryl already booked. We were talking last night, and he was like, you got a book. And I was like, man, it's so early to commit. Like, I'm not going to know what's be happening in April. But he's like, if you book, then you at least have the room. You could cancel the room. So, you know, that's true. A good point.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to cost me anything to book the room.
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah, so do you remember, like, I think I recall from one of your shows, you talking about, you know, when you started, the very first time that you started reading comics, did you get them from, like, the ones, like, that the store would get rid of and the covers torn off?
Oh, yeah,
stuff?
It was, my dad and mom didn't have a lot of money when I grew up, but my dad used to go to the dumps, and he used to find these boxes, and then he started taking me, and they were well-kept comics. They were, like, in a box, so it didn't get garbage on it, like, the boxes were sealed, and they would just rip half of the cover off. And I guess at the time, drugstores used to get some kind of compensation if they shipped the cover back and said, we didn't sell this, which is an awesome principle. And that was kind of awesome. You can get some money back for not selling something, but you never see that today. But that's what got me into it. I don't even know a lot of the covers I read. It varied from Archie, Richie Rich, Spider-Man, because none of the covers were there, and I didn't think to pay attention to the bottom, you know, what issue it was. Mm-hmm. I do remember the first ones that I bought off the stands. One was Ghosts, and it was a 20-cent issue of that. And I don't know why I picked a horror comic with all the superheroes on the rack, but I did. And then the Defenders, that Serpent Society, was one of the first ones that I read, and I remember it because one of the things that turned me on and got me excited was I wasn't used to bad guys winning.
Oh.
And in that storyline, the bad guys are winning. I was like, what is going on? Usually you have these storylines, the bad guy is doing something, the good guy wins, and then it's over. And this was like a 3-issue arc, and the bad guys won.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, like I said, the early Avenger issue, you know, just I wasn't used to, I think, only superheroes I knew from, like, probably from cartoons or something. So, and those were, especially back then, I mean, not so much now, but back in the 80s, I mean, they were pretty, you know, you didn't see too much darkness in cartoons. Yeah. And, to see just all these crazy villains and stuff, and, like you said, that storyline was pretty intense in terms of how, for a little while there, like how effectively the Masters of Evil took down the Avengers.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that hate when the bad guy wins, but I think it's more real to me. Do you know what I mean? The good guy's not always going to win. So, like, Empire Strikes Back came out, it blew my mind. I mean,
yeah,
I still remember it to this day as, like, how could you end a movie like that? You know, how could you end it?
Yeah, that Solo, might be my favorite movie.
Who's my favorite character in that, you know, that trilogy, was in Carbonite.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, how could you end like that? Luke's hand chopped off. I mean,
yeah.
It's so great. But that's why I have big fondness for, like, the Secret Society of Supervillains that DC did. And I have a big fond of characters that I don't know nothing about. So when there's a B-list character, I tend to be more attracted to that character than to the A-list, because I could always read a Superman book.
Right.
But, like, when Deadshot or somebody appeared in the early issues, it's like, wow, this I want to know more about these characters that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
So that drew me a lot to what I was purchasing early on in my comics collecting. And then, yeah, there were times where I drifted from comics, mostly in high school, but I never really completely stopped. Because it was always off the spinner rack. It was early on, and it was always trading. In other words, I'd buy one and then trade it for others. I can't believe some of the stuff I traded away. It's there was this kid, I remember him specifically in elementary school. He'd bring in a suitcase of comic books that his father gave him. And they were all 12-cent issues. Like, I'm talking, I kid you not, like Amazing Fantasy Avengers #2. You know, I remember these specifically.
Holy cow.
And he'd bring these in, and I'd trade for him and then trade away for him because I wanted the new stuff. And I'm like, what? If I knew anything at the time, it would have meant something, but I didn't retain any of the books that I traded away for that were that old, because they read differently back then to me.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, when you're a kid, it's like you just think of things differently.
Yeah. And then in middle school, just like you were saying, in middle school, I went over to this guy's house that I became friends with, and I was going through, I didn't even know what a long box was, right? Like, at the time, I was like, you store your, there's a box just made for comics? There's bags to protect these things? Like, I was like, this is all new to me. I was like, what's going on? And I was looking through the box, and I was seeing comics that I had never, ever, ever seen on the spinner rack. And I was like, where'd you get these things from? Well, it turns out they were like Marvel fanfares and things that you buy off the spinner rack. They were direct to the, and I, he says, well, I get them at the comic shop. And I, and then my mind just was blown. There's a shop just with comics? And then it was all downhill from there. I mean, yeah, I would mow a lot of lawns. And back in the day, I think the highest price comic was like 60 cents.
Mm-hmm.
I would you know, mow the grass for 20 bucks, which was a good price. I just had to mow it like every week. And then a month I'd get a $20 thing, and that was a good price for back in the day. And then that would get me a lot of freaking comics.
Definitely. Do you remember when you first went into the comic shop, like when you first actually found out about it?
It was a comic shop / bookstore. In other words, it was called Don's Paperback Books. And as in Albuquerque, New Mexico, it still exists. But it exists more now as like a book trade. Like if you have old books, you could trade them in.
Oh, yeah.
At a different, you know, exchange them for other trade paperbacks. But they still deal in comics. But they have very little on the rack. But they deal more like with pull list customers. Because I've recently went there. I have this thing where I was like, I need to go visit the shops that that I used to go to when I went back to Albuquerque, just to see if they still existed or what they look like.
Yeah.
And they've changed quite a bit.
Hmm.
Yeah. For the worse, actually. But,
yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
And there was a new shop there that's downtown that looks really cool. It's called Astro Zombies, but yeah, that's how I've always got comics, and I've always treated them like good. In other words, I bagged and boarded them. I never just thrown them around, except in the early years when I used to trade them. I used to fold them up, put them in my back pocket, and say, "Here it is." But yeah, that's my history, which you've probably heard in the past.
Yeah, I mean, bits and pieces here and there, but I mean, but yeah, that's kind of a funny thing about, like, when you started collecting and when you started reading comics, I think that was a lot more common, like, to treat comics as disposable, or like you said, fold them up, or, I mean, I think a lot of people in that, like, a lot of kids at that time did the same thing, and I mean, I think maybe when I first got my first comics from my parents, I probably wasn't too careful with them, but because of the time period, you know, because it was the mid-80s, you know, once I got into the comic shop and because of Wizard Magazine and everything, I mean, that was just, you know, you knew that that was the thing to do. You knew that you didn't, you kept your comics in as good a condition as you could, and you know, you didn't mess around with them, and you know, the whole bagging and boarding thing. I mean, I learned about a lot of that all pretty early on, I think.
Yeah, or your parents told you these might be worth something.
Yeah. Well, it's like you, especially at that time period, you couldn't get away from the idea that things might. I mean, you mentioned Valiant, and I mean, I had a couple of Valiant comics, but they were just so, like, for someone of my age at that time. You know, I remember going into like a comic shop and, you know, it's the first time I'd even see a Valiant, because I wasn't, you know, pre-ordering anything. It's like first time I even would have an opportunity to get my hands on one. The price would already be, like, compared to what I could, you know, the new stuff I could get.
Yeah, the one thing that was crazy is when I first got into Valiant, like, I don't even know what got me into Valiant. I don't even remember. But it was after, like, the first five issues or so, right? So the real expensive issues were still there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I even remember my wife back in college bought me Magnus Robot Fighter number 12.
Nice.
And I can't remember what the big deal was about number 12, but it was like the first appearance of a Valiant character, and it was in Wizard. She bought it for me for $100.
Oh my
god. I think today it's worth like maybe $12.50 or something like that.
Holy cow.
But it just shows the price of those books were really crazy at the time. Especially for like before Shooter, the Shooter issues.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely the time period I was talking about. Like, I know I had a couple, and I know I had an issue, one of the early issues of Turok. There was a Turok video game at the time, but I just didn't really get into them the way that I was into Marvel and Image, because, you know, that you'd see them, but the price was just like, it was just, you know, that's the whole, like, when the whole, you know, speculator thing came in, and hey, Harley.
Yeah, she's got a good voice there.
Yeah.
Barb was blocking her from coming inside, and she was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa."
I'm surprised Luna's gonna, she's laying in the doorway here. She's, sometimes she'll decide that it's time to go out.
Yeah.
Start making noise and stuff, but yeah, so that's kinda, I don't know, did you have anything specific that you read to talk about?
Yeah, maybe we can alternate.
Sure.
I had two issues of Strike Force Morituri. And
okay.
I thought I'd read it because I guess I heard about it on a podcast maybe a year or so ago.
Okay.
And they talked about it, and it was really, really sophisticated and way ahead of its time, in my opinion. But
when did that come out?
This was 1987.
Oh, okay.
And it was number 2. And I actually read these out of order, but it didn't really matter because I didn't know I had the other one. But it was so good. I mean, this is the bad thing about doing the back issue thing is sometimes you'll run into something you really like. Yeah. And in this case, I did. And it's by two people that – let me see if I could find the creative team because I don't even – know this guy very well. Peter B. Gillis is the writer and Brett Anderson is the penciler, and at the time Jim Shooter was the editor in chief. And
so that was Marvel then?
Yeah, it was Marvel. Okay. And the comics at this time were 75 cents. But the concept of this was really cool. It was like a Starship Troopers kind of thing. Except it had some interesting twists. It was like this alien race was invading us, and Marvel at the time chose like a really, really interesting font when the aliens were talking. It's almost hard to read, but it almost looks like Egyptian or something like that, but it's English. You can read it, but sometimes there's the letters you have to concentrate on because the font is so weird. But they're invading Earth because of the resources, etc. And there's some aliens that actually like to torture the humans, but we're getting our asses kicked, kind of like in Starship Troopers. And they formed this experiment that could grant powers to certain individuals, but the catch is the volunteers, that when they were granted the powers, they'll only have a year to live, which is like, You're kind of, by volunteering, you're sacrificing your life already, because when they inject you or whatever with this experiment, you're going to die within a year. So they're already on a short lifeline, and they're kind of in training, and their powers don't manifest right away. They're manifested through extreme stress. So it's weird because the experimenters decide to almost stress them out to the point of death before their powers manifest. But there's like five or six of them. And then they send them after the aliens. And they find out that what the aliens are doing, they're fighting these huge robots. And you're like, okay. Well, and they're defeating the robots. But then you see these human heads in the robots. And it's just a head. It's like they've detached the body and everything. And they're extreme pain. So they, like, freak out because they're killing their own people, you know? Yeah. It's like, what the hell's going on? But it really was really interesting.
Some crazy ideas in there.
Yeah, there's some crazy ideas in there. I really liked everything that I read about it. And the writing was really good. I've never heard of this Peter Gillis guy, but...
Yeah, me neither, yeah.
I'm going to go look for a trade because I still have some Amazon credits, and I think they had a trade of it. Either that, or I think these issues are like really dirt cheap, so if I run across them at a con, I will definitely, you know, look out for them, because the concept is really interesting. It's good sci-fi.
Yeah, it's funny when you go back and read stuff and you think it like ends up reminding you of a lot of things. Like there was a couple things when you were talking that it reminded me of, and like that idea came from, like, not necessarily that they took the idea from there, but you just, like, maybe something that blew your mind somewhere else, you realize, like, oh, okay, that's actually kind of similar to this, and you see, like, sort of different threads that go through, like I said, with sci-fi and stuff, like, you know, like, one thing was with, like, you're talking about stress, like, stressing people out to activate their powers, like, and, like, extreme conditions and stuff, like, kind of reminds me of, like, Harbinger, like, trying to activate like powers and stuff, but sometimes it goes wrong and doesn't work out or whatever.
Yeah, there was some really interesting, and I like the concept that these guys know that they're already going to die. That was crazy. And they even get stressed out. They're like, why aren't you sent? They're seeing their families die, like, I don't know. I keep using the Starship Troopers analogy. I really like the first movie. Yeah. When they launched the comet or whatever that spore into Buenos Aires or wherever they launched it, it killed their families, and then these young guys are like, I'm going to get revenge. And that's kind of like what this is. It's like these young kids are, you know, I'm going to sacrifice myself and go get revenge. Some interesting ads in this is they have, I guess at the time, laser tag was really big. Like you could buy a laser tag set.
Oh, yeah. I totally remember those.
I never played laser tag, believe it or not.
I don't think I ever, I played a couple times. I don't think I ever had the set myself. I think like I knew, you know, other, I played with at other kids' houses that had it or something, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that was definitely big back then.
And, yeah, I never did laser tag. It seems like we had bottle rocket fights more than anything, which were a little more dangerous.
Yeah. So you like shoot them at each other or something?
Yeah. We, well, our parent, believe our parents got involved. They would, they welded us like guns and stuff.
Holy crap.
And then, yeah, it was just as, and it hurt too, because, but it, yeah, there was an excitement about it. And I remember my brother got hit once, and I was like, don't tell mom, you gotta suck it up, suck the pain up.
It reminds me of, like, there was this group of kids. I never got real involved. They had this thing where they had these backyard wars with BB guns.
Oh, my God. I never did that.
They had rules, like, you know, but every once in a while, like, either someone would intentionally not follow the rules or, like, would mess up or something. Somebody, like, really get hurt. But
yeah, you go in the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of crazy. But aside, like, I think I knew not to get involved because one time I was riding my bike down the street when I was a kid. This house down the street, their like grandson or something like that was visiting. It wasn't somebody that lived there. But I don't know what the hell was wrong with him. But for some reason, he shot his BB gun at me as I was driving by on my bike.
Uh-huh.
And like, he said he was just trying to hit the bike itself, but like hit me in the leg.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I knew, like, I was like, kids on the bus talking about the fact they were doing this on purpose, like in this kid's backyard. I'm like, that's freaking crazy.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like fun to me.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's another ad I ran across in an earlier book about BB guns. They're selling these to kids, and it says, if you're 8 years old or older, you should go ask your dad to buy you a BB gun. And it says it comes with a booklet on how to shoot these things. And it gave you different variations. I don't know what the difference was between a BB gun and a pellet gun, but I think a pellet was bigger. I'm not sure.
Okay.
And but ages, yeah, 8 and up.
Sure.
I mean, it just goes to show, you know. Today that would, you wouldn't see that. And plus, if you had a BB gun, you're probably at risk if you go shoot it out in the open because people can't tell the difference anymore.
Oh yeah, it's totally different now.
Yeah, and there's even been kids shot before because they have a water gun or something that looks realistic or something.
Yeah, we had all kinds of guns. We had guns all over the place, like not real. I mean, but we had, you know, kids had BB guns and water guns, and everything looked real realistic. And
oh yeah, you know, and the fact that you'd play with army men. I mean, that was a huge thing when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you're buying tanks and all this stuff, and
yeah,
they're like encouraging kids for war. It's like, it was the coolest thing when I was a kid, because that's why I was so into Sergeant Rock and Unknown Soldier and all that stuff, is because mm-hmm. of the army men.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that definitely. Well, I got kind of curious about, you know, DC used to do those 16-page previews.
Mm-hmm.
They did them like, this is like basically the first half of the 80s before, up until around when Crisis was coming out. And, because, you know, I read, earlier this year, I read, you know, probably the most famous one was for New Teen Titans. And that, that came out in DC Comics Presents.
Oh, yeah. I have that. That was, talk about money. That drove a lot of money back in the day.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, it's still like, you still can't get it for a dollar, put it that way, you know.
Wasn't it in the one with Green Lantern, or am I misthinking it? DC Comics Presents.
That's a good question. I'm not sure who Superman was teaming up with in that issue. Be interesting to look.
I can't remember.
But yeah, it was. So that's probably like the most well-known one. I mean, because the cool thing about these was that, you know, you like they weren't like nowadays. You might get a preview of a new comic that's coming out, and it's pages from the actual number one. But these were, the whole thing about these was these were actual originally like original stories, and they would lead into the number one, but they were actually original stories commissioned. So like, for example, the preview of New Teen Titans involves a story with Robin, Dick Grayson, I should say Dick Grayson for Keith. you know, getting recruited by Raven for the Titans, and it definitely, it like directly runs into New Teen Titans number one. So, I mean, I have that in a trade, but I was curious as to what ones I might have in actual issues and stuff, and one of the ones I found was I had the preview for Night Force.
Oh, man! That was the other one I had. I had Night Force and the Teen Titans. I still do. But I love Night Force, so that kind of got me excited.
Yeah, I was curious about it because I haven't finished reading it, but DC has been putting out the miniseries lately.
Yeah.
It just finished, and I read the first few issues, and I was like, reading it from month to month, I was kind of having trouble following it, so I've decided that I would just collect all the issues up and read it, because it was like kind of hard to follow monthly. But so I thought that was kind of relevant to what's going on today, and I thought I would check it out. And this was actually in an issue of New Teen Titans. I think there were several that they put in New Teen Titans because it was, you know, I'm assuming because it was a big seller at the time. And this is in issue 21, and it's a story. The Titan story is a story involving brother blood. But the Night Force story is pretty cool. Like we were talking earlier about using Satanism as an element, and one of the things I noticed, like I said, I haven't finished the new Night Force, but I did read a little bit of it, and this is actually even a little bit darker in some ways. And basically, you know, you have Baron Winters, who's the guy that recruits what he calls the Night Force, and he recruits humans. I guess the way to say his basic concept was he recruits them to fight some threat.
Usually an occult threat kind of thing.
Yeah. And so these 16-page previews, I mean, technically they're like 14 pages of story. You know, and they'd be included, and it wouldn't cost any extra. Like this issue was 60 cents at the time. And it was addition to the regular comic. But that would include an original, basically cover, for lack of a better word, that introduce the preview, so you know you knew you were jumping into a different story. And then the last page of the 16 was usually like a picture of the issue one of the series. And what this basically is like you get Baron Winters recruiting the team. A few pages, there's three people that he recruits all together, and I should say that this was written by Marv Wolfman, who is the one that, you know, created the Night Force concept, and he's the one that actually is writing the miniseries coming out right now.
Yeah, he was the shit back in the day because of the Crisis on Infinite Earths, that, and the Teen Titans.
Yeah, that was coming. So, yeah, he's the one that actually wrote the Titans issue that the preview's in also. Yeah, and this came out in July of 82. So I know they were already starting to plan Crisis at that time. they were originally, I think, thinking it was going to come out even like soon, and ended up getting pushed back. But the art's by Gene Colan and Bob Smith. But yeah, so he basically, like I said, there's satanic rituals involved here. One of the characters that he's recruiting actually is this guy named Donovan Kane, who's a Georgetown professor, and it's kind of unclear, you know, I think it's meant to be to sort of draw you in, but he's doing this, he's actually quoting from the Satanic Rituals by Anton LaVey. Right, like right in the comic, he's like, there's all these like robed humans that get, like they get naked and like they're surrounding him, and I'm just like, it was cracking me up that like, because then like they go into this laboratory, so they're like doing this satanic ritual like in the college, and it's just like it's funny to me, like I don't think that this would fly nowadays, but
I don't know, they
depends,
you say that, but you know, they're knocking heads off and all that other stuff, so
yeah that's true, I guess.
And there's a lot of sexual innuendo and all that stuff in a lot of the books.
Yeah, that's true,
at least in the New 52. Well,
yeah,
I notice it.
Yeah,
I notice it more that lately because I've been talking about that on Facebook with a creator of his own company, Big Dog Inc.
Because
he's like, my books, they'll put in like the Zenoscopes area, and he says my books are no different than what's being published by DC or Marvel, and then he gives examples, and it's true, you know. You compare, and they're relatively in the same sort of level.
Yeah.
But back in the day, there was some crazy stuff that went on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as, I guess part of it was just like, I think sometimes maybe in mainstream comics they'll sort of stay away from stuff that is religious or, you know what I mean? Not so much like...
Well, now religion's more prevalent and it offends a lot more parents than I think back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think more though, so that aspect. But yeah, I mean, there's some of the things that people have gotten upset about with the New 52 and stuff. It's very interesting to go back and read stuff that, you know, are supposedly more like PG or whatever, but it's not, I mean, it's not really, like I happened to just out of coincidence be reading old New Teen Titans around the same time as the New 52 was starting last year, and everyone was having a hard time with Starfire, and but I was like literally sitting there reading like early issues of New Teen Titans when, you know, she's just meeting the other Titans and they're getting used to like her behavior and stuff like that, and it's not much different.
It's,
you know,
very sexual.
It's very similar, yeah.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So,
I got into several arguments with people over Red Hood and the Outlaws because in a couple of them I had to, you know, go do some research and get some JPEGs that showed her doing stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fairly consistent. I mean, and like her costume is more risque and to some degree, but I think it would be equivalent, like, because her costume in the early 80s, what she was wearing was pretty risque for that time. So if you're going to keep it sort of on the same level of being as risque for today, it's kind of equivalent, but yeah, so I mean, that was one of the...
Maybe the thing is there's more women reading comics now.
Because
I noticed that a lot of the complaints, it was mothers they're handing comics to their daughters to read because they saw Teen Titans on, you know, Cartoon Network.
Yeah,
Here's Raven, and they're depicted as little kids in anime style, so...
Right, and well, and there's two things there. I mean, one is, that's in my opinion, it's like you need to do your research, you know, as far as like being a parent, you know, just to assume.
Yeah, because they have ratings on them.
Yeah, and that's constantly. I mean, there's always like different versions of characters in, you know, in the cartoons versus the comics, but.
Batman's a good example. You can have the old Batman TV series with Adam West, who you can probably show to anybody. And then you can have the current Dark Knight and watch it with Heath Ledger as the Joker, and that's pretty violent.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is, like, consistency with character is important. Like, it's one thing, how you treat Starfire is one thing, or I would say Catwoman's another example, or, like, you know, people were, like, Harley Quinn was another one that people had problems with, like, the way that she was. But, I mean, it's, like, it's not, it's different than, like, I would have a problem if, like, you know, someone like Wonder Woman or, you know, like, it's a different, they're a different type of character, and if it's not, like, consistent with their character to be, like, overtly sexualized in their actions, I think it's kind of different. But it's like with Harley in the new costume and stuff, she, it's not like she's like a, like I can totally picture someone like her being kind of crazy dressing up like that. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's consistent with her character. Whereas like if you put Wonder Woman in Harley's new outfit, like that doesn't really make sense to the character, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, yeah. But that, yeah, that, so that was, so I thought it'd be cool to check out. And I like this Night Force preview. Like, it kind of, like you said, it draws you into other stuff. Now I kind of want to check out the old Night Force.
Yeah, I bought those on eBay about 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't read Night Force back in the day. I read Teen Titans, mm-hmm. but I didn't read Night Force.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess it kind of, this many years later, I guess it worked. Like,
yeah,
the preview in.
The current series is very good, but I'll agree with you. They really could have condensed it and made it really solid, I think, mini.
Mm-hmm.
Because it went out 7 issues. I haven't read the finale yet, but it seemed to draw out a lot of story in the middle that didn't need to be there. Like issues 3 through 5 or 6 were just exploring things with the villains and stuff, and it could have been condensed in a couple of panels, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But it is really good, and I'm a big fan of Tom Mandrake art. I think his art was really dark style, because I really love the, if you get a chance, the John Ostrander, Tom Mandrake Spectre, especially like the first 10 issues. Oh, God, is that good.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
The big selling point is that the first issue was a glow-in-the-dark cover. And it was hard to get at the time because it was rare again.
Yeah, cover gimmicks.
The cover gimmicks.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a few. I think I have the first few issues of the Spectre series that came out of Crisis.
Yeah.
But I haven't read them yet, but
I'm a big Spectre fan, so the next book that I had read for my little dive into the long boxes was Adventure Comics 437 and 438.
Nice.
And these ones, what year are these from? These are from 1975.
Okay.
Let me know if you hear a lot of background noise, because I'm going to open the door a little bit, and you might... Do you hear a lot of background?
No.
Okay.
No, like I heard you open it and like a little bit of, I don't know.
Let me know, because we have like I live like in a cul-de-sac, but my backyard faces an area where the speed limit's like 45, and sometimes you could hear the cars whizzing by.
Oh, okay.
I just don't want Harley to run in the door while I'm talking about the Spectre. So this time period I find really fascinating, because at the time, some of the comics, like the mainstream heroes, weren't violent at all. But this is a violent specter. I mean, it really is a violent specter. And this one, this particular story takes off where this guy is kidnapping people, and the specter knows that he's kidnapping these people, and he's actually sending them. He brainwashes them and put bombs on them, and they like go into banks, steal the money, and if they don't steal the money, then they'll self-destruct. So they happen to take Jim Corrigan's girl, one of the girls that he knows, so he gets really involved in it. And they put these bombs on him, but the Spectre, I don't know how Jim Corrigan could be a detective in this era, because he'll never succeed, because the Spectre kills everybody, so as the detective, you've never completed any cases, because the Spectre just go and annihilate these people. And he usually does it in the way that they're doing it. That's the irony of the situation. And the second feature, let me tell you who the creative team is. Michael Fleschner. And they reprinted a lot of his stuff back in the 80s with some Spectre Deluxe books, which I think I own. And then the art was Ernie Chua and Jim Aparo. So it was like a big, big artist for the time was Jim Aparo. Mm-hmm. Mostly known for his work on Batman, you know.
Yeah,
he did the Death in the Family and a lot of other stuff. Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of Aquaman, believe it or not. And the backup features an Aquaman story with this script is by Paul Levitz, who's still writing at DC, and art by Mike Grell, who's another artist I recently got a commission of. Warlord, I love Warlord, and
That was his big thing, right, around that
time. Yeah, and his Green Arrow, Longbow Hunters and stuff. It was just breakthrough at the time.
Yeah.
To me, that is my favorite Green Arrow, is the Mike Grell years. Mm. That's my Ollie Queen. And the Dennis O'Neill when he was teaming up with, you know, Green Lantern, Green Arrow. That's my Ollie.
Right, yeah.
The Aquaman story was okay. It was just him getting blasted by black mana and then finding this tunnel underneath and finding this weird creature. The pages are, there's only like, it's an 8-page story, and then the rest is the Spectre. So the Spectre had like 20 pages, and then the backup was just 8 pages. But really interesting letter columns. Because at the time period, there wasn't a lot of violence in comics, and this is going both ways in the positive and the negative. So you'll have people write in saying, I'm blown away by this issue. You know, what you depicted the Spectre and the way he's a vigilante, he's killing villains. I mean, and he's pretty much invulnerable. I haven't seen him at this time that they could do anything about it. If the Spectre comes to you, you're pretty much dead. There are people that are saying, how could you publish this book? He's not a hero. How are you with the hero book? So I also found that really interesting.
Yeah. And yeah, like two decades later, that's all people would want.
Yep. And then the following issue was really interesting too, because it was called The Museum of Fear, and it had this professor. The first professor in the first book was a professor that was bad, that was stealing money and putting bombs on people. This one here was capturing people and making wax figures of them. So it's like House of Wax kind of thing. And he was stealing people, and Corrigan gets involved and again kills the... In this one, I've never seen him use this ability, but he does like a dead man thing where he's able to kill one of the bad guys, and then he goes undercover as one of the bad guys.
So
he morphs his body into a physical representation of one of the bad guys and goes to find that professor. And in this one, he has a bunch of wax apes that were killed and stuffed. This guy's basically doing taxidermy. He's not waxing them. He's basically killing people and then doing taxidermy on them and putting them in the museum, kind of like in the Natural History Museum, making displays with them. But he kills him there. And then the second feature was cool because it was the Seven Soldiers of Victory. And this was one of the things that they found in a file cabinet. So they had a Golden Age story, and you can tell it's a Golden Age story. And they had a modern artist draw it. So the Golden Age story written, but then they had Dick Dillon draw it. And then very much in the Golden Age style in team books is what mm-hmm. they have, is they have the team all together, and then they send the individuals out to do a certain mission, and then they join again. Yeah. Team. But this one had Shining Knight, Howard Chaykin art, and in 1970, what was it, five, his art doesn't look anything like Howard Chaykin today.
Oh really?
Or even when he was doing like American Flag, it looks, if I showed you this art, you would never guess it was Howard Chaykin.
What is it? Is it a lot just more basic, like not stylized or something?
It's, well, back in this time, I think a lot of people drew like each other. In other words, DC was promoting a certain style, right? So a lot of the art, the same.
That's true. Yeah, I guess it was it was a lot less about creator names and
right. More about it's more about a company style that we want you to draw.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd like to post a page of this just to say, here, look at this Howard Chaykin art.
Yeah, totally.
It's kind of interesting, but yeah, Adventure Comics. These were 25-cent comics, and man, this good Spectre stuff. But it's like a Tales from the Crypt formula. In other words, mm-hmm. except with vengeance, they basically set up a crazy crime, and the crimes are usually really violent, at least for the time of 1975. And then a Spectre goes and kills them. Like, I've seen him, like, there was a barbershop guy killing people at the barbershop chairs, and then he used scissors to chop off his head. It's like he'll use whatever you did against you.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, it was good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny how, you know, because the comics code was still around, but like how they over time loosen things up and they would find ways to get around the comics code and just like things like that. It's like a good example of like, you know, how the code changed or how they would find ways around it.
Yeah, this is, I think, when they opened up the comics code again. In other words, when Marvel started to do the monsters again and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they originally said no vampires, no zombies, no Walking Dead, no buried people. I mean, there was a lot of weird things that came out of the comics code. You even sent me the article on Altered Ego. This is when they started to loosen up again, and I think it wasn't as restrictive.
Yeah, they were like, well, we effectively killed EC Comics, so now we can, you know, now we can start introducing some of the things that we put in the code specifically to put them out of business, not because we really had a problem with it.
Yeah.
I also had the 16-page preview for Amethyst.
Oh, I don't have
one.
But now I'm interested because I'm really enjoying it.
Right, that's why I was kind of just with Night Force now, you know, she's in, what's the actual Sword and Sorcery?
Sword and Sorcery, yeah.
Yeah. So this was in an issue of Legion of Superheroes from April of 83. It's Legion of Superheroes 298. And the preview was written by Don Miskin and Gary Cohn. And the art's by Ernie Colon. And it's interesting because it took sort of a different approach. Like, I did read the Zero issue of Sword and Sorcery with Amethyst, and it takes a different approach. It's like, it starts in... So it takes place in place called Gem World, and it starts out with Lord Opal, and apparently there are 12 gems, and he has 11 of them. And, of course, the one that he's missing is Amethyst. And Princess Amethyst, of course, has the gem. And so, you know, we don't... It's like the whole thing is that Amethyst actually comes from... I don't know if you want to say it's our world, but like a more like a world more similar to ours, and like the DC and the one that just, you know, the Zero issue that just came out, it kind of starts, you know, they took a different approach where you identify with her as the main character because it starts in a world more like ours or in the main DC universe, and then you go through the experience with her of finding out about this other world and everything. This kind of does it the opposite way, where it starts in Gem World and you don't really get a sense that. You just think it's like kind of like a fantasy comic and stuff until the first sign you get something is that something happens and Amethyst compares it to a time when she was 8 and she threw a steak bone down the garbage disposal. And the dude that she's with is like, what? What are you talking about? She's just like, just never mind. I'll explain later. So you're like, okay, maybe something weird is going on. And that's like on page 8 of the preview. So like until then, you're like, oh, it's just a fantasy story. And they're like, oh, wait a minute. What's going on? Maybe something else is going on here. But that's about it until at the very end of the preview, the bottom half of the page, the last 3 panels, she opens up a... she uses her Amethyst gem to open up a portal because she thinks her mom and dad are worried about her, and she goes to this portal and she's looks a little younger, and she like falls out of this portal into her bedroom. She's got a Wonder Woman poster on her wall. And because of the big noise she makes falling out of the portal, her mom from somewhere else in the house is like, are you all right? And she says, yeah, I just was having a bad dream. And then she's thinking to herself, how can I tell them the truth? They'll think I'm crazy. But sooner or later, they'll have to find out their 13-year-old daughter is really Amethyst. And then there's, you know, a little ad to, I guess it was not an ongoing, but it was like a maxi series.
Yeah.
So they tell you to check out the issue number 1 on sale next month. So, it was kind of interesting, like, to compare. Contrast it with the approach they're taking now.
I think that one actually has a tie in to Crisis on Infinite Earths too.
Yeah, I think there was like one of the issues.
Yeah,
tie in and stuff, which is kind of neat. So this would, it would have been 83. So yeah, like a couple years later.
Did you read the Legion thing too, or no?
I didn't read the issue yet, Legion, because I had read. I've been kind of collecting. For back when I was, one of the things, like when we were talking earlier about the podcast I started doing, I was kind of like the approach I was taking, it turned out to be like kind of tough to follow just because it was kind of restrictive, but I was using that website, Mike's World of Comics, and was looking at issues that came out right around 1980, month by month. So coincidentally, that happened to be the time when, Legion of Superheroes went from being Superboy in Legion of Superheroes, and I think it was 259 was the issue that was for the first time ever, it was just Legion of Superheroes without Superboy involved, and Superboy goes back to Smallville, and they launched a new Superboy number 1 to show his adventures and stuff. So I've read like a handful of those Legion issue starting there, so and I'm kind of collecting the one. This is 298, so I'm kind of collecting the ones in between. I want to kind of read them in order and stuff.
Who was the team at that time on Legion? Do you know?
The time that of the issue that
the Amethyst one, yeah.
Oh, I see Dawnstar, or is that it, Dawn? The chick with
the tracker.
Wildfire. Looks like Lightning Lad and Dream Girl's there.
Who was drawing it? Do you know?
Let me look. I got it right here. Keith Giffen.
Oh, wow.
Paul Levitz and Keith Giffen are listed as writer, plotter, and penciler, so it looks like they plotted it together.
Is this a clean style Keith Giffen, or is it a blocky style or line Keith Giffen?
It's pretty clean style.
Okay.
You know, there's like, it's pretty realistic, and there's a little bit of characterization in the faces, but it's, I'd say it's pretty straightforward, pretty realistic looking. And I guess the inker, Larry Malstedt is the inker, Carl Gafford colorist. But
yeah, that's an interesting era that I'd like to go back and read, because I've never learned a lot about Legion pre-90s.
Yeah.
Don't have a lot of them, that's for sure.
Yeah, the first time I ever read any Legion was the Abnett Lanning Legion. And I same kind of the way I got into Flash, is like I just saw that I wanted to start trying out DC stuff. I wanted to get more into DC, and so I was looking at what was being reviewed well online, and you know, The Flash was getting really good reviews, and Legion was getting really good reviews, and I thought I'd try it out, and I got, you know, I enjoyed it, and sort of kept following it through the next reboot with Mark Waid and stuff. But yeah, I don't, a lot of the older Legion stuff, though, I wasn't familiar with, so it's been cool that I haven't read a lot of them yet, like I said, but I started collecting them, and it's been cool to like go back and read them.
Yeah, I'm interested, just because, especially what I'm specifically wanting to check out is the Mike Grell issues. I only have like one or two of them, but because I'm such a Mike Grell fan, I might as well complete that, you know?
Yeah, so he did some issues around the same time period?
Yeah, I think it's roughly around that period.
They were going through a lot of
pencilers. Yeah, it was the controversial years where Cosmic Boy had the bustier. And they always make fun of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the Mike Grell years. That's what I want to get. I have a few others. I read Black Magic. This is from 1975 DC Comics. A horror book, and I think what this is, based on what I read it and the style that it was written on, is it's Golden Age stories that are reprinted. So, this is like a Tales from the Crypt, but not as much bang, not as much punch.
Mm.
The first story, and the reason I also think it's from the Golden Age is because the first story doesn't even have a creative team on it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an interesting story where this woman, I guess they're fairly well-to-do, decides to buy her house while her husband's in Africa doing some hunting. And this house, she goes in and it's really weird-looking, and she looks behind a curtain and sees a murder scene. And the catch on this one is it's a scene that... She calls the police, and the police are like, "You're crazy. There's nothing going on. This house is empty." And her husband comes back and she thinks she's just stressed out about, you know, things and stuff like that. But then they go to a party and she sees two people at the party, and they're the two people that were involved in the murder. You know, the woman was stabbing the man, and it kind of ends like that. There's nothing she can do about it, but she thinks she's seeing the future.
Was like they always did the surprise endings.
Yeah. The next story kind of blew my mind. It's Who Walks in My Dream. And the reason it blew my mind is because I am a huge Kirby fan. I mean, I preach at the altar of Kirby. But I don't know much of the Golden Age Kirby. Like, the Cap stuff, and I guess in this case it's like horror stuff that he did. This is This one did have a creative team, and it's Simon and Kirby, so the creators of Cap.
Yeah.
And this was a horror story that was very, very dense. In other words, it's an 8-page story or so. It took me 20 minutes to read. But it was a story about this guy who's like a lab guy. He does inventions and stuff like that. And he's just getting all stressed out about work and stuff. And he's having these nightmares. And then these nightmares, he's killing people. And then he wakes up in those mornings and his shoes have dirt on them and there's blood on his shirt and shit like that.
Yeah.
And, he eventually goes and sees a psychiatrist and kills his psychiatrist. And it just, he ends up jumping out a window.
Like, I don't think, you know, Kirby's not really known for doing horror, so that.
Yeah. And then the next story is also a Simon and Kirby, and it's called The Woman in the Tower. And it's basically about this woman, I think, who's dreaming, and she's dreaming that she's in the tower, but she's not in the tower. She's just lost her marbles. So, yeah, it was an interesting story, and I have never read Black Magic before, ever.
So, it was like an anthology series? And.
I'm going to go do research on it just to find out if I really think it is Golden Age. But this is number 9, and it sure read like a Golden Age. And the fact that there was no creative teams,
right?
It sure looked that way. And just the time period, like just because it's Simon, you know, Simon and Kirby, he was at Marvel at this time. So, you know, I just don't think I think it's a reprint print of his old horror work.
Yeah, because I'm not an expert by any means on Kirby, but I want to say, like, I don't think him and Simon didn't really work together much outside of Golden Age, right?
Yeah, everything I know is, like, Fighting American, Captain America. I know they did a lot of stuff together before they went their separate ways. Matter of fact, I was just reading about some of it in back issue.
I might bring
it up at a later time when I have more time to finish the article.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think there's some stuff, and I won't be able to remember much of it. But I know I was like browsing a website that had like Golden Age comics that were in public domain.
Yeah.
And there was something that Simon and Kirby had worked on together, just some random, like, the character was pretty similar. It, like, definitely reminded me of, like, a take on the Captain America origin. I think he was, like, a football player or something like that, but I think it was Blue something. I don't know. I won't be able to remember, but, they put out a lot of stuff.
They sure did. And then exploded. Kirby exploded at Marvel.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing.
And then I think a lot of his DC work, which is what I prefer, is ignored. I mean, not so much ignored, but it's not as big as his Fantastic Four and his Cap and his, you know, all this other stuff.
Well, that was kind of like his why I've gotten more curious everything. About him.
Yeah.
You know, because I still haven't read a lot of it, but I always knew him for the Marvel stuff and the early 60s stuff and all of that. And finding out about the DC stuff that he's done definitely been intriguing to me, because I feel like conceptually, you know, he was such a big name at that point that, you know, DC brought him over. Just kind of, at least initially, it seems like it was just kind of carte blanche to, like, that's how they attracted him, was like, just do what you want. Like, and I just think it's so, like, just so fascinating, like his ideas, you know.
That's where I began to think that he created a lot what we saw in Fantastic Four and other stuff, because like the Silver Surfer and Galactus, that had to come from his mind. It had to, just because of what he did in DC and just cut loose, you know.
Yeah.
It falls right in there. The Inhumans. I think he wrote more than, or plotted more. I will say plotted more. He plotted more than people give him credit for.
Right.
You know, when it said Stan Lee and Kirby, the fact that, Stanley wrote some notes on a piece of paper and said, draw the whole damn thing, and then I'll go fill in the dialogue.
Yeah.
It just says that he really plotted the stories. That it was more than just what he got on that notepad, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, who else is going to create like a cosmic being that rides a surfboard?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely a thing. I mean, like, then you got... Like,
whereas the dialogue is definitely Stan.
I mean... Yeah. But yeah, I think when it comes down to... You have to agree with you, like, in terms of when it comes down to, like, all the concepts and stuff. Conceptually, you look at that stuff, and it seems to be in line of a similar nature to, like, concepts he did at DC.
So blown away by his art. I mean... I'm more of a story guy, and I just get blown away by his stuff and his concepts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've come to, like I said, I still have to go back, and I want to collect a lot of the, you know, trades that DC has put out of that era. I haven't actually read a lot of it, but I do, like I have in recent years, become really fascinated with that stuff. And
yeah.
I mean, part of it, you know, I was one of the people that definitely was enjoying the recent OMAC along with you, and you know, and that style, I just love it. You know, I just love looking at it.
Yeah.
I got a really cheap hardcover of Kirby, just an overview, Kirby King of Comics, I think it's called, or something. DCBS had it real cheap, and it's a lot of, I mean, there's text, but there's a lot of really big pictures, and, you know, I just can, it appeals to me because that's kind of like I do like realistic style, like George Perez style stuff. But then also the other kind of style I gravitate towards is like artists I think come from like influence of Kirby that is a little more stylized. I wouldn't say like cartoony in the sense that like meaning like the way that like actual cartoons look, but. You know, stuff that, like, what's his name? Darwin Cook and...
Oh, yeah.
Cameron Stewart and... or, like, David Aja or...
Uh-huh.
Like, all that's kind of stuff that...
But you're mentioning...
Approach.
Yeah, art styles that you could actually look at and say, I know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Kirby art's about, right? I mean, you could look at Kirby art... And look at it and kind of know it was Kirby. Unless you go to his Golden Age stuff. Like, if you show me his Golden Age stuff, I don't think I could pick it out. I really don't.
Yeah, I guess he probably, being young, I mean, like a lot of artists, and you look at their earlier stuff, it's if they haven't quite developed their style to make themselves unique, you know?
Right.
But did you need to run, or you got a little more time, or
it's up to you?
Okay, I mean, I have some more time. I maybe take like a 2-minute break or something. I'm gonna run to the bathroom.
Okay, I'll just pause this here for a sec.
Okay.
All right.
I'll be back in a minute.
Back.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Did you have any other books or any other notes?
Yeah. I did read one other of those 16-page previews that I had. This one was like a little bit different because it was a licensed property. So
I know what you're getting at. I think I do because I have that one too.
Well, there was a few that they did, and it seems like the ones I mentioned before and the New Teen Titans stuff. Those only came out in one comic, like it was only that particular issue, and it seems like when I was looking, doing a little research, it looks like they changed that later on with some of the ones that they did. And this one was Masters of the Universe, and I mean I have it in New Teen Titans 25, but it also appeared in like 14 other issues, so like looks like they put it in most of the ones that they published that month, which is like Well, I mean, this was like November 82, so the Amethyst one, so I don't know if the fact that it was a licensed property led them to put it in a lot more or not.
I'd put it in as much because you're paying extra for it, so.
Yeah, so they probably like really wanted to get it out there and stuff, although, you know, on the covers of the other ones that I mentioned, on the cover of those comics, there's a pretty big, like, maybe like an inch and a half border that talks about the fact that there's like the free preview inside. This one just has like a little ribbon along the bottom corner that mentions it. But anyways, yeah, so this is Masters of the Universe or He-Man. I thought that this was kind of interesting because this license has kind of been, Marvel, I think, had the license for a little while later on in the 80s. And, you know, DC's been putting stuff out again recently. But it doesn't seem, they haven't been promoting it too heavily.
Yeah, it seems to be in the back burner. But they also had some weird situation where the first issue came out and then the second one was like 4 months later. So. That was bizarre, and then they resolicited it again.
And the writer changed or something too, right?
Yep, in issue two. It changed right off the bat, yeah.
Yeah. But this is pretty wild. I didn't know what I was going to get here. This is Paul Kupperberg is the writer, and it's Kurt Swan art with Dave Hunt Inks, and it starts off actually talking about the multiverse. So this is, you know, I guess they're kind of tying this into Eternia, where He-Man takes place. And it starts out with the character Zodak, and he's like really similar to Metron, speaking of Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he flies on this, like, floating chair through the cosmos, and he's like coming back talking about he's been traveling in the dimensional planes, and but he's returning to Eternia. And then we switch to the court of Eternia, and like in the I did collect He-Man when I was a kid, and I watched the cartoon and stuff. And in the cartoon, so He-Man's alter ego is Prince Adam, and unless my memory is faulty, like I remember him in the cartoon just kind of being real timid and kind of like a weakling, sort of. And it was kind of funny to me because in the comic here, like there's definitely still a contrast, but he's more of like a screw up. Like he walks into the court with like a woman on each side of him. He seems, they're contrasting him more as like just being like this like badass kind of screw up that's like disappointing his parents and stuff.
Right. But he's got ladies.
Yeah. He's got ladies, and he's just like what is like man at arms.
Is that his father?
Or man is at arms.
Yeah.
No, he's like his father is the king.
But Man at Arms has a daughter, right?
Yeah, I think that's Tila.
Tila, okay, that's what
daughter. Yeah. We need like the Star Joes guys on here to help us at this
one. Us.
Like, what the hell are they talking about? So the main thing that cracked me up about this, like, so there's something. So Prince Adam sneaks off, and he gets Cringer, his cat, who turns into Battle Cat. So there's a threat, so they run off to deal with Skeletor, of course. And but where things really started cracking me up is on page 7, we switch to Earth and Superman. So I was like not expecting to see Superman in this. So they were tying it into, I don't know if it's because Kurt Swan was involved. He's like, I gotta draw Superman, but
with a barrel chest. I always think of Swan as the barrel chest artist.
Yeah, he's Robert Atkins influence. So Superman fights this like sea creature that pops up out of nowhere, and then these like two or three flying objects go flying past him, and he goes following after him, and they fly into the sea. He follows after them, and they create this vortex. So he ends up getting transported by this vortex to Eternia, and there's like a editor's note that tells us that he's been to Eternia before, which I guess was in DC Presents 47. So I guess this is like not the first time that Superman is teamed up with He-Man.
Yeah, I think his first appearance was in that DC Comics Presents.
Yeah. I've never read that, but I do remember just, hearing about that.
I read it, but man, I don't remember it at all.
Yeah.
That's another one I just recently went to fill. I think the only ones I'm missing in that series are like 1 through 8.
Oh, wow. Yeah. There's a lot of cool team-ups in there.
Yeah. It's an interesting book, just like Brave and the Bold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Superman arrives and immediately goes flying down and at Skeletor, and Skeletor has at this point like both halves of the power sword. So Superman flies down and just like snags both pieces of it from him. But like immediately messes him up because it's magic based. So he just whips both halves, and the half that belongs to Skeletor goes back to him, but the other one just goes like flying just into the distance. And of course it like ends up where He-Man's at in a battle. And so, you know, like this is like almost the end of the preview, but the thing that really cracked me up was at the end. You know, they're just kind of wrapping things up. It's just like exposition, and He-Man is standing there with Zodak and Superman, and you know, Zodak, it's like this huge word bubble that Zodak is kind of just summing up, you know, like, okay, well, we won, and this and that happened, and everything, and but then like Superman says, that's all well and good, but will someone please explain what I'm doing here? And that's the way it ends.
It's because like, Kurt Swan drew him in there.
Yeah, like I just thought it was funny that it ended that way, because you know, it's just like the same thing you're thinking. It's like, why the hell is Superman in this comic? He's like thinking the same thing, like, what the. So somebody tell me what the hell's going on.
I don't know the history of that book, but it didn't live long at DC, did it?
I don't think so, because I want to say that by the late 80s, Marvel was publishing Masters.
Within the Star imprint or something? Or
yeah, I don't know. But because like Marvel, they're not so much nowadays, but they were pretty huge on licensed properties in the 80s. They had a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah,
you know, G.I. Joe and Masters and
Rom the Space Knight,
Rom Micronauts, like
that,
all of
that guy fascinates me because the toy failed, but the comic lasted 75 issues.
I know, and they're like, I mean, they don't have the rights to Rom, but they're calling him Space Knight.
And yeah,
there's like a 3-issue miniseries coming out.
Yeah,
that technically is Rom, but they can't call it Rom, but. Yeah, they had a lot of stuff. Like, and I, you know, they were doing Conan in the 80s.
John Carter, Warlord of Mars, they did some of that. But that might have been 70s.
Yeah, I think it was. But yeah, they were doing a lot of stuff. Like, and they don't do that much of it now. But their properties are pretty, I mean.
Yeah, with DC does more of it, but. Huge. They don't do so much of it anymore.
Yeah. They,
mostly video game based.
Yeah, that's true.
Or role playing.
Mm-hmm. On TV, like I guess they're doing that. that's related to that. What's the show called? The one that actually Robert Atkins is working on?
Oh, Castle.
Yeah, Castle, yeah. But
They did Halo, too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but did you have another one or?
Yeah, I have another quick one. I started reading Brave and the Bold. I read 152, 167. They were 40-cent comics from what year? 1979. The one with the Atom was interesting because it was this this computer guy. I forget what his name was. But he's a computer dude that basically robbed Bruce Wayne of all his money and Ray Palmer of college funds or whatever, and took all their money and put it in a Swiss bank account kind of thing. And they eventually find out who he is, but he's a pretty good hacker. Some of the things that were really interesting in here is back in the day, they used to have Ask the Answer Man, and I used to love that. And it was, you'd write a question in and then he would answer it. And some of the questions were like, has Steve Gerber written any comics for DC? And he says, yeah, Metalman number 45 and some issues of Mr. Miracle. The next question was, where are the Secret Society of Supervillains? He says, currently in the Justice League. And then who illustrated Rima magazine you did a few years ago? That was Rima the Jungle Girl, who recently appeared, well, not recently, but maybe a year or two ago in First Wave, which I've been reading lately. How is the Ocean Masters Aquaman's half-brother? And he answers, they had the same father. Then a bunch of questions like, will Phantom Stranger and Metamorpho be in the Justice League? Phantom Stranger, I never think would be in the Justice League. And he says, possibly, it's always those answers. Who is the youngest of the jail heirs? And he says, good question, but since we've never established their ages, I'm not going to give you an answer. I like his answers because Keith, I think, would like them, especially with some of the mistakes they make. This was a Legion question, which I would have never known. Why is Princess Projecta called Jekki in the comic book? And he said it's short for Projectra. That's a weird name. It doesn't get close to it for me. And then at the time, they said which JLAers have never had their own magazine, and that was Green Arrow, Black Canary, Hawk Girl, Zatanna, Red Tornado, and Elongated Man. Are there two Wonder Woman? And he said, yeah, one from Earth 1 and Earth 2. Are we ever going to see Plastic Man again? He said, at this time, he said plans are in the works for him to show up at the Daily Planet. I don't know if that ever happened or not. If Batman and Robin are in Gotham City, how could Batgirl and Robin be in New York? That's one of the continuity questions. And he said they were tracking down the outsider.
That's like these people are like Keith's predecessors.
Yeah.
Like writing in like these things.
Yeah, except he does it on Twitter, except he can't Twitter anymore.
Yeah.
Where did Elliot S. Megan go to? I don't even know who that is. Massachusetts, where he's teaching. I should probably know who that is. I'll have to Google it. Where are the Sea Devils ever meet Aquaman? He says, maybe. Could be an interesting story. I really love the ads at this time period, too, because they were like ads that would really sell you on a book.
Yeah.
That's the other thing to point out. And then it had Hempbacks, you know, Fred Hempback cartoons in them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This one says, the other day it's a Flash one. It says, the other day I spotted Captain Cold and decided to go after him. Only my wife Iris was washing my uniform, unknown to me. So I pressed my ring device and ran two blocks before I realized people were yelling, there goes the Flasher, not the Flash.
So corny.
Yeah, and then this had one big issue. This issue meant a lot to me. It was the Flash number 275, and it was a costume party, and it says, you're cordially invited to attend the last dance and witness the death of, and they cover the name, but this impacted me a lot when I read it off of the off of those newsstands. It was good. I'd recommend it if you're a Flash fan.
Is that was that the Professor Zoom?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Really big issue.
I haven't. I'm just looking here because I've gotten close to. Like years ago, I started collecting and wanting to complete the full run of the Wally West Flash, and then I'm close to getting most of those, and I've started to pick up I've started to pick up later issues of the Barry Allen run, and as I see them, like for decent price and stuff, and so I'm just looking to see. Oh, it's $277. I have actually. I knew like the first one I had was somewhere around there, but. Mm.
I love Kerry Bates' Flash. That's one of my favorite Flash writers. He's amazing.
Yeah, I'm interested now that, like I said, until Rebirth and everything like Barry Allen, to me, I hadn't read anything to me. So he was always just the guy that, died in Crisis.
Yeah.
But since he's been back and stuff, it's kind of, at some point, I guess I'm going to start collecting the issues and stuff and read some of it. I've only read a few of the issues in it, but I do have, like, the first two volumes of the Flash Chronicles that they put out.
So do I. So maybe we could tag team on that.
You there?
Yeah.
Oh.
I think it was one of those famous Skype skips.
Yeah, like I didn't even notice anything. It's just like a window popped up and said there was internet connection problem.
Yeah.
I was like, I still hear him.
I don't get that. I just get the skip.
Mm.
It lasts for about 2.5 seconds. I don't know why it happens.
Okay. So, yeah. Well, it seems like we... there's no shortage of stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
And I thought, like I said, the only recording I've done podcasting like was myself. So, I thought that I had set up Pamela to record, and I thought it was just going to pop up when the call started, but I don't know if it did. I don't think it did.
I use Pretty May, and it's recording right now, so I'm good.
Okay, but yeah, I mean, if you need any help or anything like that, or if I'll need to learn a little bit, but if you need any help with like recording or editing or anything like that, I'm happy to. You can just shoot me some details of how to go about or what you do when you edit or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to share the burden as far as that goes.
Cool beans. There's a couple things I wanted to point out here. I never realized that DC's... You know how Marvel used to have those stamps where you'd be able to collect the stamps that were in... Well, maybe you don't know because it was like in the 70s. But
no,
DC had their own.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you could collect them. And they had some weird characters like Sephra, who was appearing in Super Friends at the time. And I would like to find these stamps. And there was another Keith question into Ask the Answer Man I thought was funny. It said, why wasn't Batman wearing his utility belt at the end of Batman 251? And then he answers him. He says, because Neil Adams forgot to draw it in, and nobody caught the mistake until the book was printed.
Nice. I didn't even try to make something up.
Yeah.
So that's like...
I like his answers because he just says it was a mistake.
Yeah, like instead of trying to like come up with some fake reason, they know it's fake.
Oh yeah, we misspelled it. That's why we fucked up.
Yeah. I think that's all like people, like the editors on Twitter that Keith... I think that's...
Stalked, yeah. I think that's why his Twitter account is enabled and he can't tweet anymore. It's not the browser, it's...
Yeah, they shut him down.
They shut him down.
I was looking at this, like, the Titans issue that this Masters of the Universe thing was in. The title page has, you know, like the lineup of all the characters, and then the Omega Men are in this storyline, so it's got all the Omega Men listed.
Ah.
And, like, you know, it's just like little faces with their name underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is still pretty much the classic Titans lineup. This is 25 from the original installment, not the Baxter one, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's certain things, like, I love the Titans. I love the whole, like, as I've gotten, like I said, I didn't grow up with DC, but as I've gotten back, one of the things that really appeals to me is the whole notion of, you know, sidekicks and the way that they started to deal with them in this series in the 80s. The whole concept of, you know, taking them from being, like, Wolfman's whole thing was to take these characters that he didn't feel like acted like real teenagers and try to make them act more like they would. And
yeah, because the previous incarnation was kind of 70s-ish.
Yeah. And that's actually, speaking of that Jeanette Kahn interview and back issues, one of the things that they talked to her about was how, you know, they really had to sell her on the concept Wolfman and Perez, in other words, because, you know, the previous series Titans had ended a few years earlier, and it was a really poor seller, you know, and she wasn't really interested in the whole idea and just thought, you know, the characters were boring, but they sold her on the concept, you know, and ended up being their biggest seller. But for me, just, I mean, it's one of the things with Wally West that's also appealing is I love the idea of legacy characters. And when you look at comics in general, I mean, he's one of the few that have ever really owned, you know, the mantle of another character, where he became, for a lot of people, their Flash, you know?
Yeah. And
there's not many more examples of that are, at least to that extent, you know, because, you know, with, like, Kyle Rayner being the Green Lantern, it's like, yes, but, like, for a while he was the only one, but technically, you know, there's so many Green Lanterns. And when you look at Dick Grayson, like, you know,
that happened much, much later, too.
Much later, and it was, you always knew it wasn't going to be something that lasted forever. I mean, it was really cool to see that, and I really liked when that happened. You know, the times that he has stepped up and become Batman, it's a really cool storyline, but, I mean, it wasn't on the same level. And Wally being the Flash, you know, for a while, you really pretty much expected that to remain status quo, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was always going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's like a whole, I could talk a while about the whole concept of the Flashes. And
yeah, it goes back a long ways. The Jay Garrick. And then, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they even teamed up in the original series, you know, when they started crossing over Earth 1 and Earth 2.
Yeah.
And it was a very strange concept at the time, but I think that's what kicked it off, actually.
Uh-huh.
Flash of Two Worlds. It kicked off the two Earths.
Yeah, that's what everyone always seems to point to, at least, as, like, the story that introduced the whole concept. You know, because Barry was reading a Flash comic before he became the Flash. That's why, like, when I don't think it was him that called himself the Flash, but someone else did. And then the reason he liked it was because it reminded him of
the comic.
Yeah, his comic. So that was cool.
Well, I'm a fan of Wally and Kyle, to tell you the truth, because they're. I grew up with the other incarnations, and they were more heroic, in my opinion, but the others had faults, and they were more humane and human than the previous incarnations, because Hal's always been one-dimensional to me. and a lot to Barry's extent, he's always been kind of the same thing. But when Wally came, I don't know. He was very, he had a personality. And so did Kyle. And they were full of faults. And they had to learn to be a hero.
Right. Yeah, and I think following that journey is, you know, you identify with it a lot more. And I mean, I think part of it's not so much, it's not so much inherent in Hale and Barry that, you know, it's just the time period that they were written about.
Right.
Originally, you know, it just happened to be a symptom of the era versus when Wally became the Flash and Kyle was introduced, you know, it was just, it's a symptom of how you wrote about characters. I mean, you gave them flaws and made them identifiable that way. And, you know, characterization in the 80s became a lot bigger than just, you know, having crazy plots. So part of it's that, you know what I mean? But that's, yeah, it's kind of interesting because a lot of times it falls down to who you grew up with. But for you, that's like...
Yeah, it's a little different. I love a lot of Kerry Bates' Flash, but it was more about story than to me than it was like his personality. Mm-hmm. And more for Wally, it was more personality.
Yeah, well, and I think that wasn't an accident.
And he kind of took that role hesitant. He didn't like want the mantle. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He kind of felt like Barry died to save us. And I kind of have to own up to it.
Right.
But I don't think he wanted that responsibility.
No, I mean, that was the whole storyline, you know, through New Titans leading up to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he's brought into... I mean, he didn't even want to be a part of... you know, he wouldn't even want to be Kid Flash and didn't even want to be a part of the New Titans, and he wouldn't have joined if Raven hadn't manipulated him, and the whole fallout from her doing that and his reluctance was pretty much, and before he'd become the Flash, you know, he'd quit being Kid Flash at the same time that Robin quit to become Nightwing. He was basically, you know, going to, again, for like the second time or third time, going to quit being a superhero. And like you said, it was only because of Barry dying in Crisis that he sort of felt that he needed to.
And when death meant something.
In
other words, back then you didn't think they'd come back. Now you're, you know, they'll be back in a year or two.
Yeah, but yeah, you were. I was going to mention that you were saying about characterization, and you know, it was definitely intentional because at that time, one of the other things from the Jeanette Kahn interview, this is right near the end of what I had last read. You know, they're asking her about 85, 86, around this time period, and you know, asking her about revamping the Trinity and what the thinking was about that, and asked her if they felt at the time that they needed to be revamped. And she said, I thought our flagship characters desperately needed to be revamped. In our stories prior to Crisis and other watershed books like Dark Knight and Year One, plot was almost always imposed upon the characters. What we wanted to do was reverse that equation and have the characters determine the plot. That was the underlying fundament of the changes to our three major characters and then to all our characters. And then they just go on to talk about some of the specifics of, you know, getting John Byrne involved with Superman and George Perez with Wonder Woman. But so, yeah, I mean, it sounds like they were very specifically shifting the characterization. So
you could definitely see it at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you want to wrap this guy up?
Yeah, I probably should go eat some lunch.
And catch some football.
Yep.
All right, so this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast, number one.
Number one.
I'm in the process of getting you a Comic Book Noise account.
Oh, sweet.
And an account so you can log into the Geek Brunch site so you could help me like post stuff or if you want to post stuff. But okay. It hasn't happened yet, so... Can you give your Twitter information and where to contact you currently?
Sure, yeah. Like I said earlier, I'm a MythMaking, etc. on Twitter, which is MythMaking ETC. I'm MythMaking, etc. on Forum for Geeks. And you can, making it easy, you can also email me, MythMaking, etc. at gmail.com.
And I am Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter, Mike at comicbooknoise.com. And we have a we'll have a Forum for Geeks site underneath Geek Brunch too. So
awesome.
I'll get that set up. But I want to thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, and, very fun.
For you know, for us talking the very first time, I think we got a lot in common, and we have a lot to talk about, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I kind of suspect that just the interactions we've had through like Twitter and stuff like that, that there'd be a lot to talk about when you talked about doing. You know, I kind of jumped on as soon as you mentioned on Twitter that you're wanting to do this, that sounded awesome. And, you know, like I said, it was something I've been wanting to do, and yeah. Finding a way to, like you said, but it's a lot better when you have somebody to talk to instead of staring at the wall, talking to yourself and zoning out and having
right.
to go back and edit out these, like, 30-second pauses all over the place.
Yeah, and since it's just the two of us currently, I'm flexible. So, like, if you can't do something and we want to do a short recording or whatever, we could, you know, adjust times or days or whatever.
Yeah, so, that sounds cool. Most Sundays work for me, but, you know, we can just be in touch. Like, I'm pretty flexible, too.
So I'll probably release this later in the week. Because okay. I still haven't released Geek Brunch yet. Matter of fact, I was editing it before we started, and I didn't finish.
Yeah.
The upload takes a while, and I didn't want to FTP while we were recording because my bandwidth really goes to crap when I'm uploading.
Oh yeah. Uploading definitely. Yeah, whenever you get a chance, I'm sympathetic to the fact that you have 3 podcasts now. Sort of. That's why I said, like, you know, at some point, shoot me some instructions, and I'll get the hang of. I mean, I have a basic.
It's really pretty easy because I don't edit it. I basically take the recording, I levelate it, especially mm-hmm. if we have more than 2 guests, because our volumes could be at different, recorded on my end at different volume
right.
levels.
Yeah,
and then. I usually put a beginning and an end, and I won't know what to do with this one yet. As far as like, if you could think of like some music or something that you want to put on there, or find some intro, I'm all for it, but I haven't thought about that yet.
It's too
far in the future.
No, I mean, if we start out with like, you know, the basic Geek Brunch stuff, or
yeah,
I'll start my Songify career and. guess, You actually, I was walking around saying, because like you had, on Twitter or Facebook, you said something about Blasphemous Rumors, and so I had that stuck in my head this morning.
Oh, man, that song I really liked back in the day.
Yeah, Depeche Mode was pretty awesome.
Yeah, really a fan, and I had a chance to see him when we first moved to Denver, but then they canceled, and I haven't seen him in concert, so.
That sucks.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him either, but it always sucks when you're that close.
Yeah.
Like cancel or something.
A matter of fact, one of my Pandora stations now is New Wave Punk, which is like a lot of Ramones and a lot of the punk bands of the time, and Depeche Mode and The Cure and stuff.
Oh yeah, I love that stuff.
I like.
Yeah, definitely.
Have that playing a lot lately at work.
And I know we mentioned we can also. I tend to get in different modes and different periods, like, and I tend to go through phases when it comes to watching movies and stuff. I'll watch a lot of them, then I won't watch a lot, but, and now that the winter is coming up, you know, I'll probably watch a lot more, but can talk about some retro movies and stuff like that. And
yeah, I'd like to do that. And I want,
if you eat any stale food or something, you can talk about retro food.
Yeah.
Find anything at the back of the closet, tell us how you survived afterwards. But
that sounds great.
All right.
You have a good day. And who's your football team, by the way?
Oh, the Bills.
Oh, it's mine too.
Oh, really? How did you?
I don't know if you noticed, but a lot of times when I take pictures of Harley, she's sleeping on a Bills blanket.
Oh, no, I didn't notice that, but I have noticed you mention them sometimes. I'm like, how is he a Bills fan?
Well, I come from Albuquerque. New Mexico doesn't have a team. The closest teams they have are Dallas and Denver. And at the time, my love for B characters, I guess, I didn't want to pick a team that was...
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, was in the area because that was all that was shown on TV. Mm-hmm. And... I picked a football player that I liked, and it was mostly from cards. Like, and this was later on. Yeah. It was from. I picked James Lofton.
Oh yeah.
And I followed him from the Packers over to the Bills.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I remember him.
I've kind of stuck with those two teams ever since. So those are my. I have an NFC team and an AFC team, the Packers and the Bills. But in actuality, I really bonded to the Bills with the no-huddle offense and stuff. And
yeah.
I've stuck with them ever since through these crazy years. But that's the team that I watch. I watch the Buffalo Bills.
Well, you'll be, if anyone that I know from here listens to this, you'll be popular then. Because that's the whole – I mean, they definitely epitomize, like, our communities what do you call it, like the atmosphere here, you know?
Yeah.
The whole underdog thing, like people, it's the whole kind of situation where people from here will complain about Buffalo, but if anyone from outside the city comes here and complains about it, like they'll like destroy you. It's very defensive. It's very like...
Oh, I love them. And throughout the years, they've had some really bad years, but they have some years where they might make it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this year could turn out to be a 500 season. I mean, it's really weird what I'm seeing in the games today.
Mm-hmm.
It sure looks like the Pats, unfortunately, are going to take the division. But I think Buffalo could come in second in the division.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said that in, like a couple of weeks ago, but last week was much better than the previous when they got killed by San Francisco. And that game against the Pats, I was like, it started off so well, and then I just was so depressing. It's always extra depressing when they play them.
Yeah,
I can't stand the
England. Hey, you know the one Bill jersey I have. Like I have a football jersey, and you know who's on it? Travis Henry. He was kind of kicked out of football.
Yeah.
Denver.
Like, oh, man.
But I've always liked the Buffalo backs. I just think they get rid of them too early. I really do. Because there's a lot of great backs that came from Buffalo right now playing on other teams.
Yeah, they've had a lot of problems. But so, yeah, I'm used to the punishment. Basically, and I just because I was such an impressionable age when they had all the Super Bowl appearances.
Yeah,
and I took it so personally and so emotionally because I was a kid and I still have like imprinted in my brain.
Wide, you know, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. That just makes it.
They had that Super Bowl.
I know.
And they were the best offensive team any of those years. I mean, they. That no huddle was just amazing. I just didn't know what happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah. There's lots of theories, but...
Like, you know, Keith would say, it's a damn shame.
Yeah. I just had to sit there as a kid and say, dang.
But but even during the Flutie years, I loved... Because he was so short, but... He would still get it done, and then Rob Johnson come in with his sock. I don't know. I just remember that.
Well, people love Flutie around here still. A couple years ago, we had a breakfast cereal, Flutie Flakes, around here.
Yeah.
And a couple years ago, I think it was, they like brought him back out for like a limited release or something like that. But yeah, he was popular around here because anybody, all you have to do if you're on a sports team here, whether it's them or the Sabres, all you have to do is say that you like it here and that you like living here, that's all you have to do. And then, because like people are so used here, are so used to people making fun of and dumping on Buffalo and complaining about it, that an athlete that comes here, all they have to do is say they like it here and it's a nice place, and they're in. It doesn't matter how they play.
They're appreciated.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate Buffalo, and it's the one team that I do follow. I just hope that they can get back to winning that division, because I don't like the Patriots.
Oh, I know. One of my friends in college was from Massachusetts, and it just made it even worse for me, because he is so, like, annoying about New England sports.
Yeah.
It just made me hate them even more. But, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I've been paying a little more attention, because I'm for the first time in a long time, playing fantasy football with Star Joe's League.
Yeah.
And I thought I was awesome, because the first 2 weeks I was talking trash, because I won the first 2 weeks in a row, and then
I haven't won. I'm the champ!
Yeah, I know. I was starting to talk trash on Chuck on the forums and stuff, and then I haven't won since. So I'm like 2-4, so I haven't said much lately. But yeah, so we'll see. I don't know.
I actually kind of went out of fantasy football 2 years ago, and I kind of enjoy it, because I was actually rooting for players that I can't stand.
Yeah.
So I was picking up. I was trying to win, and I was found myself turning it to teams that I didn't like, and it got really weird. And I ended up watching, instead of watching Buffalo or Green Bay games, I was watching the Red Zone channel.
Yeah. I'm not crazy into it. I just was like, this will be fun.
Yeah.
Because
I played, it was always for money, so it really,
really
meant something.
I wouldn't have done this if it was for money, because there's like 16 teams, so. I mean, by the time we were drafting our bench, I think one of the guys I drafted plays for like the middle school team down the street. it's like just such scrubs by the end. I mean, it's like, yeah. So it's for fun, you know. Nothing, no money involved. So that's good for me. That's all I need. So.
Well, I gotta go take Carly for a walk. So you have a good one.
Yeah, you too.
Take care.
All right. Bye. You too. Bye.
Pipewright, the toy that lets you create beautiful pictures with light. Work with colorful pegs that glow with light. Light bulb not included. Make people, animals, things. And with rebuilds, Bugs Bunny or Bozo the Clown. You can make lots of pretty pictures with Light Bright from Hasbro.